You are listening to the OneOfUs.net Podcast Network.
Something's coming.
Stand by. Hold on to your hats. Here we go.
Welcome to the Screamcast episode 118. I am Sean DeRager, and with me as always is Brad Henderson.
Insert yawn here.
Silky smooth voice.
It only took me, like, you know, 118 episodes in order to get a better mic. So.
Well, you sound super sexy, and I am jealous because my setup doesn't sound as good as yours. And my setup looks legit, but what'd you get? The blue ball mic? The blue ball?
I do have blue balls. however, I got the snowball mic. Yeah.
Yeah, those snowball mics are good.
Yeah, so we'll test it out. We'll see. Because I started out speaking through my phone, was our first few episodes, which was a very, very good choice. That was a garbage can sound. And then I moved up to, the mic that Sean provided.
Yeah, that's just a piece of shit $20 mic.
Well, there you go. Then I moved up to tin can. And now I'm silky smooth, Brad. So you can just call me that from now on.
All right, silky smooth, Brad. Today we have a pretty badass show. By the way, BJ got stuck at rehearsal, so she's unable to join us for this part of the show.
I'll just take her what's on your doorstep segments. I'll just cover additional five.
I emailed her, or I texted her a crying emoji to express my feelings.
That is how you do it these days. like a preteen.
Yeah.
There you go.
My daughter and I will have complete conversations via emoji.
Yep. It's the same thing with me. Yeah. Willow and I text, and being that iPhone update, there's GIFs and all this other shit you can put in there, and I just get Trump GIFs all day long. So it's pretty funny.
He covers the wide gambit of disgust,
yeah,
and stupidity.
Hey, at least she knows that, and she's only 11. So
my daughter does too, and she's 11. I have faith in our next generation. I really do.
Least you do. You'll just have to talk me into it.
Well, anyway, this week we are going to be talking Dead End Drive-In, the release from Arrow. We are talking to Brian Trenchard Smith. Shit, is it Trenchard or Trenchard? God damn it.
Just say Trenchard.
Is it Trenchard?
Smith. Trenchard. Just say Trenchard Smith.
Make a note. I'm going to make a note here because I need
Brian Trenchard Smith. That's how
Brian
I say
Trenchard
it.
Brian Trenchard Smith. Yeah, okay.
You know, I'm not saying a professional, even though one of the listeners called me out for pronouncing anthology wrong. I'm sorry. I grew up in Ohio, and my dad is from West Virginia. It's no excuse, but there are some words that, you know, for example, I don't say, I have to force myself to say it. I don't say pillow. I say pillow. It's just part of it. Sorry. But I know I say anthology, yeah. Like anno, I understand, but anthology.
There you go. There you go. Practice it a few times.
I know. I got it. When it's I okay. think about it, I can do it, you know, I can say it properly, but every once in a while, like when I'm in mid sentence, there are some words that I, you know, mispronounce. It's just because of my, you know, redneck upbringing from part of my father who says, you know, coral and boral and oral and stuff like that. So my apologies.
My brother would say pancake until his teens.
That sounds that's awful. That's nothing like anthology.
All right. Anyway, now maybe I won't edit that out. Look, Brian, I apologize that I butchered your name. At least I butchered it at the start of the show as opposed to when I interviewed you, even though the interview happened a few days ago.
You kind of paused. You kind of paused when you very first said something to him.
Yeah.
It was pretty embarrassing. It almost ruined everything.
The problem is I second guess myself when I start pronouncing things. I just need to go for it.
Yeah, like anthology, right?
Yeah.
There you go.
We're not perfect, and that's okay. Anyway, Brian Trenchard-Smith is going to be joining us to discuss Dead End Drive-In and some other flicks in his career, including Turkey Shoot.
And his book.
So stay tuned for that.
Tomorrow.
But first, we need to jump into what's on our doorstep.
Holy cow, I almost forgot.
We'll get the door.
Hit it, Sean.
Hold on, let me open up a bottle of water.
Oh, my.
That's how I party.
I'm drinking coffee shop of horrors from Grossbusters.
I'm drinking Market Pantry purified drinking water. So basically it's just piss that's been, ran through some filters.
Pissed by some hipsters. The hipsters piss in a bottle for you?
Yep. Those of you who are annoyed at slurping sounds, I apologize.
Ooh, I've been called out for that before, too. Oh, come to think of it, a lot of listeners probably hate me. I still love you guys, so it doesn't bother me. I pick on everybody, so like I can take it.
I think now that your voice is sultry smooth, I think you're going to change some people around. I think people are going to start, liking you a little bit more.
You think they really lasted 118 episodes?
No, fuck them.
No way. I want to know, because we have to know, because, certain people listen to episodes here and there. They don't listen to every episode. We have a few, I believe, religious listeners, but I mean, our numbers are great, but I want to know if, because obviously listen to this show, I'm not going to tweet this out. I want to know who has listened to this is 118 episodes of Sean and I from the very beginning. Even if you came in later, let's say episode 50 or episode 30 or episode, 100. I want to know if you went back and if you've completed. I'm not talking about like, hey, you started at one and you plan on getting through. I want to know somebody that has a completionist. I want to know every completionist listener, and we'll put you in for a drawing or some shit.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
So just at me, bro, and let me know. At us. Isn't that what they just say now? Is that like a thing?
I don't listen to podcasts.
I'm talking about on the twits.
Oh. Yeah, at me, bro.
There you go.
Come
there
at me, bro. Go. That's a ghost show. You gonna throw a brick, bro?
What was that thing that you said with Ryan Turk? Ghostroids?
Oh, yeah, it was Ryan Turk. Yeah, the Ghostroids.
Ghostroids.
That's fantastic. All right.
Just so cracks me up.
We're doing the thing that I hate where the podcast hosts just go off and just start talking about bullshit.
Our religious listeners love our stupid fucking banter at this point. Like, it'd be different if we're just starting out like episode 3.
Okay.
We're done.
Well, meanwhile, like thousands have stopped listening and our loyal 5 are still here. What's up, guys?
Thousands.
And gals. It's like probably like 4 guys and 1 gal.
More like 10,000, Sean. But anyways.
All right. I'll go first. How's that?
You must. I mean, I wouldn't have it any other way. And you wouldn't either, so.
No. Well, the first thing I wanted to talk about really quick, because I just started watching this, The Shallows. We had some people disagree with us on The Shallows, by the way, and disagree with me on Constantine, the movie. I apologize.
I can't win them all, but at least I won Constantine, which I'm a lot more proud of than winning anything over The Shallows. I want The Shallows out of my life.
All right. Well, I started watching, kind of going through Scream Factory's release of The Thing. And first of all, I got to say, this is the best I've ever seen that film. It's probably in my top 10 films of all time.
That's a bold statement.
I think it's
in a lot of people's.
But it was
Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah,
I would say.
I didn't see Big Trouble in Little China until later, actually. But The Thing was one of the first movies that really got me hooked on kind of creature features and practical effects. I didn't even see the movie all the way through when I first saw it. My first introduction to The Thing was when it popped out of the dog, and that whole sequence. And
that's the first
scene? It's near the beginning. Yeah.
No. I'm saying that's the first scene that you saw.
Yes, of the film.
So, like when you were younger, like how old were you?
I was probably like 8 or 9.
Oh shit! Oh, it's like your parents watching it or some shit?
It was on. It was like on HBO or something.
Oh,
it was on. It was at like my grandparents' house.
I mean that's a great experience.
And it was like disgusting and totally freaked me out. But I couldn't look away, and I was just so hooked at that whole idea. And I watched parts of the movie, and I got scared around the room a couple times, and you know. But then I always went back to the thing, and you know, it's I watched that movie so many times, especially in college, and it's just one of those films I always go back to, and an example of like just impeccable practical effects. So it looks great. The last release was okay. I didn't really have any huge problems with it. It looked fine to me, but this looks incredible. It looks great. The special features are fantastic. There's a great conversation with John Carpenter on there. He's interviewed by.
Ooh, I hear you typing.
Yeah, we're gonna see if I can find it here.
I'm gonna edit this, John.
Probably. I don't know. I don't know anymore. Sometimes I want to edit the show and make it all tight. And
here's the thing. But, here's the thing is that there's too many shows and too many podcasts. Same thing, I guess. But there's too much where people are like, you know, have all that shit mapped out. They've looked it up, you know, in order to make maybe the show move more, you know, smooth. But all in all, I mean, no one knows everything.
No.
You know, so if you have to look it up, you look it up.
I think we're good. I found this pretty fast. So
you did a great job.
There's an interview with John Carpenter, which is fantastic. I can listen to John Carpenter talk about baseball.
That's an old interview, though.
This is a new one. Oh, Mike Garris sits down with him. Mick Garris? Garris. Yeah. Sits down
with John Carpenter. Now you cross the line and making mistakes.
I misread it. Mick Garris sits down, and they have a conversation about the movie. It's great.
Mick Garris is a great moderator. I mean, I know
he's really good.
He's a really good moderator for anything, really.
Awesome.
He's also a great speaker.
And the other new one of the new features, there's a whole bunch. I haven't gotten through them all. I mean, there's so much. There's hours and hours and hours of stuff on here. But there's a feature interview with Keith David, Wilford Brimley, who I actually couldn't believe was still alive. David Clennon.
I know that.
Thomas Waits, Peter Maloney, Richard Masser, and Joel Polis. It's fantastic. It's all those guys being interviewed.
Rob G do like an interview with Dean Cundey?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because that's when the whole thing where he cheated and he put that out beforehand. I know what you did, Rob, but I still love you. But it was really cool has to be. Isn't it a commentary?
Oh, commentary. Well, yeah. Audio commentary with Dean Cundey. Yep.
Yeah, that's where they Dean relays the secret of who actually is the thing.
Right.
Glare in the people's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fascinating.
That's so great. If you're a fan of the thing, I mean, this thing, this no pun intended, but this Blu-ray is stacked. I mean, this is the end-all, be-all release of the thing.
As it should be.
It's fantastic. And if you've been, because I've been kind of I've been kind of critical of Scream Factory, you know, double dipping in these. Like now they got Child's Play coming out and.
But they're doing new transfers, so it's.
Exactly. So.
They get a free pass. Because here's the thing is they put a sour taste in everybody's mouth because they did it for so long of re-releasing stuff just again. On Blu-ray without actually touching it other than doing special features.
Yeah.
And people like me, I could give a shit about special features sometimes. Like, I want the best quality picture if I'm forking over $20 or $25.
Yeah.
I could read what you put in on that interview on the fucking internet. Like, I don't need to watch a fucking well-produced, you know, something by Redshirt, even though they do great work and I'm, you know, very happy they exist. But I mean, seriously, I don't want to fork over that much money when I'm probably not going to watch the interview anyway. Like, unless it's a movie that, you know, I don't know too much about, and then I'll dive into the special features. Yeah. But, you know, you fucking stack Child's Play. I know everything about Child's Play. Fucking come at me, bro.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, the movie, the thing looks great. But these two new interviews for sure, like, I feel like there are some things in the John Carpenter interview that I didn't know. And there's things for sure, just seeing these guys relive their experience now, like at this many years later. I mean, Wilford Brimley's like in his, he's like 82, you know, and he's just sitting there, he's just hunched over in his, you know, big old gigantic chair, just, you know, reminiscing about the film. It's great. And it's great. And Keith David is, you know, I love listening to that guy talk. And, so hearing all their interviews and all their perspectives, was just great. And everything else is just kind of icing on the cake. Those two things are fantastic. Anyway, it's just a stacked disc. And then, you know, I got the next one to be diving into is the Carrie, special edition, collector's edition. But yeah, the Scream Factory really has put in the effort for these re-releases, because I never thought I would buy Carrie again. I wasn't planning on buying Child's Play again. I wasn't even, you know, I was the thing I'll buy whatever it comes out on. But like all these films, I wasn't really planning, because I already owned the Blu-rays, so I wasn't really going to double dip. But they've done such a great job on these that, like, if they keep this up, it's a no-brainer. I'll double dip. Because sometimes even, like, Criterion will double dip. You know, like, they're going to be releasing Pan's Labyrinth. That disc is already stacked. And I usually end up with, if I rebuy a Criterion film, like, there's really not much new to the film. It's just labeled Criterion, you know? So I don't know, but Scream Factory is doing it right on these. So, as long as they keep doing this, I'll keep buying them. So that's the thing. Next up, I watched another John Carpenter flick. This was a comedy, Memoirs of an Invisible Man, Chevy Chase. This is HD on Vudu. Did we talk about it? I don't think we've talked about it.
Oh,
we were.
It seems like you watched this a while ago, though.
I did, but I keep forgetting to mention it.
Oh, okay. Go right ahead.
But it's HD in on Vudu, and Chevy Chase and Daryl Hannah, and a lot of people kind of shit on this film. Like, I really had fun rewatching it.
I enjoy it.
Some of these early digital effects, they're actually done really well. And it's just a fun, you know, Chevy Chase film, and Sam Neill is in it. I mean, you know, I had a lot of fun with it. It's a shame that this isn't on Blu-ray anywhere with, you know, I think all John Carpenter's films should just be on Blu-ray and,
Warner Brothers, right?
I think so.
Yeah. So that's the reason why it's on HD on Vudu, because all their shit is.
Yeah.
Usually.
But it looks good. Looks fine. And I had a really fun time revisiting this, kind of take on the Invisible Man in a sense, where this, very selfish guy, rich guy, basically turns invisible and shit goes down. I don't know. But it's fun to see John Carpenter kind of as a hired gun and take on a film like this. And, you know, I always like it when a director kind of goes outside his wheelhouse and tries something different. I know he got, you know, like I said, crapped on for doing it, but, you know, I think it's great. I think it holds up. It's a fun little comedy. I don't know. All right. Next up, me and the family checked out Ghostbusters, the 2016 one, the extended version. And I don't know if we've talked about this remake that much on the show. I don't really want to dwell on it too much.
Did you see it at the theater?
I saw it in the theater, and it was okay.
You talked about it on the show.
Huh?
You talked about it on the show.
Yeah, but I watched the extended version.
Oh, wow. You watched an extra 10 minutes? Extra. Did it get better? Minutes.
It flows better, but it's not necessarily a better film. There's a few extra laughs, but, you know, it flows better. I don't know why they do this, why they cut movies.
You
want
to talk
like
about, I will fucking destroy you even more over that than The Shallows.
Well, I mean, Ghost, it's not a great film. My daughter loves it. She had fun with it.
Oh, God.
It's fun watching as a family, but it does not hold a candle to the original Ghostbusters at all.
It's a huge
missed opportunity, I think.
I wouldn't even compare the film.
It's a fun popcorn flick. But go, like, rail on it, man.
No, I'm not going to. I don't want to rail on it. I mean, here's the thing is that I don't even want to compare it. You know, cause I think it's unfair. Let the movie stand on its own, you know, because, I mean, they are, you know, basically remaking. You know, they did remake. It's a remake because nothing exists in Ghostbusters world aside for they have these weird fucking out of place cameos throughout the film. But I mean, it's just that I don't know, man. We talked, I think, via text or something about certain things, but it's just it doesn't flow well. It becomes a standard slapstick comedy rather than, you know, here's the thing is that I don't want to compare it to the original because I mean I've never met anybody that dislikes the original Ghostbusters. So you're going on territory already where you're going to have a large fan base go against you, and we saw that happen. And then they casted all females, which was even a bigger no-no to all these people. I could give a shit. I was actually excited that they announced it. I was on board a Ghostbusters 3 and a remake the entire time until Melissa McCarthy was casted and Kristen Wiig, just because I don't find them funny. The girl that plays Holtzman, she was hilarious.
I feel like they didn't give her enough to do, and I think that was my biggest thing. Like, she just.
For the best, because you don't want to overdo it like they do Kristen Wiig. But, like, the whole sequence, like, with Thor, whatever, what was his name?
Chris Hemsworth,
like. The sequence where they're interviewing him and then he shuts his eyes when noises are loud and like he just is a fumbling idiot. Like, are you trying to make fun of Rick Moranis' character? Like, I don't understand. Like, it seemed like they tried to make fun of all the pre-existing characters. That's what it felt like to me.
Yeah.
They're making fun of like kind of how geeky Egon was with the Holtzman character.
Yeah.
You know, that's just how it felt through and through.
The Ghostbusters original movie, those characters felt real and grounded. Like, they felt like people you knew. You know what I mean? And the comedy came out of kind of their interactions with each other and with the supernatural other characters.
Like, all those guys have long-standing relationships with one.
But it was very believable, where this just felt like a scripted comedy. A lot of these modern comedies feel too forced with the comedy, and it doesn't feel like real comedy, like real, like things that are funny and things that stick with you aren't necessarily people trying to be really funny. It's the situation and the person in the situation where this just seemed like it was trying too hard to make a bunch of jokes. So the extended version kind of, it stretches things out a little bit. So these moments breathe a little better, but it's still not a better film, you know, on its own as a comedy, because it's one of these modern Paul Feig comedies, which I they're okay, but they're not great. Like, they're never these long. I'll never go back and rewatch them. They are what they are, like Bridesmaids and Spy.
See, I haven't seen Spy, but I've seen
Spy.
I've seen
probably Heat. His best one, but it's and
I've Heat. Seen Heat and Bridesmaids, and both of those films I truly, truly dislike.
I hated Heat. It, like I said, like he's trying to do these movies that were kind of staples of the 80s, but he's taking out the grounded realism with these characters and just joke after joke after joke, and they're not really that.
But the thing is, the jokes aren't even that funny.
No, right, yeah.
And I haven't seen the theatrical cut of Ghostbusters. I went in because Janice wanted to rent the, you know, movies, so she picked the extended because she had no idea. And dude, that movie's like fucking over 2 hours long, and that is brutal. I went in with kind of a positive attitude. I mean, mainly because I was super positive, like I said, until they casted Melissa McCarthy. That was my biggest pet peeve. And I don't find Kristen Wiig funny, and I'm not a big comedy fan, so I'm a little, you know, I'm a little biased when it comes to that stuff because I'm like, ugh, whatever. Like, the thing is, I enjoy like comedy like Ghostbusters, but I knew casting with them in previous work from Paul Feig or whatever his name is, I just knew that this isn't going to be for me at all. It feels like they're failing with their jokes to me. Now, I wish that I maybe saw it in the theater, so I could see people's reactions, but it just was not funny. Like, I was, I don't know. Yeah. I want to know if anybody that was like, any listeners that really, really didn't want to see the movie but ended up liking it, let me know. I just because I want to know who liked it, because not only did that movie, you know, upset a bunch of people, it didn't do very well to begin with.
Yeah, like, they're not doing that. I mean, they were planning this as a trilogy. If you kind of rewatching it, I kind of saw some things they're doing. They're basically going to stretch the first movie, the original Ghostbusters, that whole plot with Gozer into three movies, which I don't think is the best thing to do. But anyway, the silver lining in this flick is my 11-year-old daughter, who is a huge fan of Ghostbusters in general. She loved this film. She loved the fact that there are these girls fighting the ghosts. So that, you know, and it turned her on to the real Ghostbusters cartoon. She had a friend over and she wanted to watch the original Ghostbusters, the first one that she likes the best. She likes Ghostbusters too. So her, like, this whole Ghostbusters thing, like, she likes it as a whole. And this is just another entry into that, but with girls. So she's young and she's not going to tear apart a movie like we would as adults. So me kind of viewing it through her eyes and my kid's eyes, even my little 4-year-old, yeah, even though there's jokes in there that are totally going to go over a 4-year-old's head, he is even like a fan of Ghostbusters in general because this movie helps stir all that up. So, you know, I can appreciate it for that. I mean, if the kids are watching it, I'm not going to be like, oh God, they're watching. I mean, it's not horrible. It's just, you look at the potential, kind of set by the original, and it's like, it really could have been updated properly. But it's just, I feel like it just turned into a Paul Feig, movie. And if you like those movies, great. But I feel like his movies mostly aren't for me. Like, I liked Jason Statham in Spy. Like, he was the best part of that movie. But man, that's about it. That's all I want to say on it. You know, I mean, Ghostbusters have been beaten to the friggin' ground, you know.
Moving on.
So, finally, this is a movie that I've been thinking about since I saw it the other day. This is released on Wilgo USA released this. It's a South Korean film called The Wailing by Na Hong Jin. And Brad, you've talked about this before when it was out in the theaters.
Yeah, already reviewed it.
It's out on Blu-ray right now.
All those longtime listeners have heard my opinions on it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now it's my turn to weigh in.
Go ahead, Sean. Let me know what you thought.
Well, when I first saw this, I was like, it's like 2.5 hours. And I was like, oh, shit. I was like,
oh, my God.
Yes, that's a long time for a horror movie. You know what I mean? But
it's a little more than a horror film.
Exactly. And I thought this was just going to be some, you know, just Asian horror film. I didn't really know what I was getting into at all. And the more that I was watching it, the more I saw things unfold. I mean, it's this South Korean. It's like this village police officer in the city, and a bunch of strange shit has been going on. A lot of murders and people kind of freaking out and just murdering people, and they're trying to figure that out. And they kind of link it to possibly this Japanese guy that's been roaming around, and eventually his daughter gets possibly possessed by a demon, and then the movie goes on and him trying to figure out why is his daughter possessed. Is it this Japanese guy? You know, what's going on? Why are these strange things happening? And all this stuff. So that's basic plot, like, sounds pretty standard, but there's this layer of like, Judeo-Christian, mythology slash, mixed in with kind of, Eastern religion. And I'm not sure like what South Koreans, what religion is kind of the main religion there, but, so there's like this mishmash of religious subtext to the film and the dealing with good and evil. And I don't want to spoil anything. I mean, this is something that, you know, you're going to want to watch and sit down and have some coffee and really like drive and pile into this movie, like, and dissect it. Cause there's so much more going on under the surface with the film. And I loved it, man. I've been thinking about this since I saw it, trying to kind of unravel the ending, and And I want to go back and rewatch it, because I know now with what I know, like, I know there's other things kind of woven in there. And but I feel like you also maybe have to know the whatever the Eastern religion is, like with their kind of exorcist rituals, because like there's a scene where they're, you know, they have this shaman come in and he's trying to get rid of the demon or whatever and going through this big ritual, and there's kind of these two dueling rituals going on, and I feel like I don't know enough about that culture to really, you know, let that sink in. So, but anyway, it's a really good film. I would recommend this to anybody. I think it's fairly cheap on Blu-ray as well. You can grab it for $14.99 at Best Buy, and I think it's streaming as well. So
it's a great movie.
Hold on, my dog's scratching at the door. Jesus Christ!
Oh, I'll talk.
All right, Brad. So
also,
what's on your doorstep? Oh no, I want to hold on. I want to hear.
No, it's going to talk about Na Hong Jing.
Yeah. Hold on.
So he did two other films called The Chaser and The Yellow Sea. And both of those films are worthy as well. And if you want to watch some long Korean dramas and action sequences or action films, but it's contained action. But yeah, The Yellow Sea and The Chaser are definitely ones to look up. I mean, the guy's got three movies out, and like he's just nailing it one right after the other.
I read that this took like 6 years to make.
It could be. I mean, that's 6 years ago is probably his last movie. Yeah. So
I mean, it's just like the way it's shot, the effects, like this is like The Shining level good. You know what I mean? Like it's a well made film. Right? No.
I agree.
Because sometimes you see these movies and they're really good, but there's some like really shoddy special effects and there's some shoddy framing. Like the cinematography is great, the effects are fantastic. You can tell that this film was like they were passionate about doing it. You know what I mean? Like everyone involved, like the acting is just top notch. I love like the lead character. I just love his attitude because he's just kind of, he has a daughter. Is he divorced? I didn't really catch that. Is he a single parent?
Yeah, I believe he's divorced. I guess. Yeah.
But he'll just kind of like be crouched down smoking a cigarette, you know, and just kind of the way he reacts to things. Like, I don't know, like just the way
he's just out of it.
Yeah, and that
he's kind of bumbling. He's kind of a bumbling like police officer as well.
I don't know, man. It's one of those films I really can't wait to rewatch. I mean, if I had time, I probably would have turned around and just rewatched it like right away. It's one of those films for me. And that doesn't happen very often these days because I'm just so busy and don't really have a lot of time to rewatch things. Like this one, like I need to carve out some time to rewatch it. So I'm probably overselling it, but I really loved it and I haven't really latched onto a film like this in a while. So.
Oh.
That's the wailing.
Impressive.
All right. What you got, Brad?
All right. Here we go. So I got around to watching a movie that I guess, it was released this year. Lights Out eventually came out on VOD. I don't know if it's out on Blu-ray yet, but it hit VOD to buy the other day. I don't know if it's to rent just yet. But it's on Vudu on demand. I dug it. You know, I know a lot of people had some problems with it, but I mean, I didn't really go in expecting that much. I just, you know, it was, of course, the short kind of went viral twice in a way. Like I remember when it very first like went on, like I think I first saw it like on E-Bombs World or some shit like that. And then eventually it sparked up again on Horror Sites. Very effective short. Great short, and then made into a feature. And I was like, okay, you know, just extend that. You know, it was creepy. Let's just do more creepy shit. And that's what they did. It's not great or anything, but I think it has some really effective scares, some really, really fucking cool gags. Because the premise is that, you know, this lady named Diana, she lives in the dark. Rio Bella's character, she is haunted by this woman. She is a single mom, lives with her little boy, her oldest, or her, her daughter, who is, you know, probably in her 20s, moved out, you know, lives across town. The little boy can't sleep because he can see Diana and hear Diana. So he goes to his older sister and says, "Hey, I need to sleep. You know, can I stay with you?" So, you know, social services gets involved. Find out the mom has some, you know, depression issues. She's on medication. You find out she was like in an asylum when she was younger, and that's where she friended, you know, this Diana character. You know, some shit happens, of course, and I'm spoiler free. Some shit happens, and Diana haunts her. And the only way that she can contact you is, or, you know, can touch you is in the dark. So she controls the light. You turn on the light, she disappears. Turn it off, she appears. Very much what the short does. But using that kind of that gag, they do some really, really cool shit and creative things with light and darkness. But yeah, I mean, it's creepy. The character Diana is pretty effective and pretty fucking scary, I think. But I mean, if you just want a fun little popcorn horror flick, Lights Out is probably for you. If you're looking for something, you know, fucking revolutionary, you're not going to get it.
It had pretty decent reviews though. Like it's not.
Yeah,
like
it's, it seems like it's mixed for me. Like I feel like it's just, cause I, even when I text you, I think I got like the unfair treatment, like The Boy did, where I think people were just expecting too much. Cause I think at certain times, you have to learn to kind of turn it off, like, you know, going into a movie. But also, like, even if they're not creative with the plot, which Lights Out plot isn't that creative, the same thing with The Boy, it's how they present it that's good. You know, because The Boy is shot very well. You know, it kind of keeps you guessing. Very standard plot. The same thing with Lights Out. But I think with Lights Out, there's so many effective scares and so many effective gags that it kind of keeps you going, you know, and it's fucking 80 minutes. Like, what more do you want? So next up was I got around to watching, you know, a film that I've watched countless times. Got around to watching the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. I said that a little too fast. This is, you know, of course, the Tobe Hooper film that came out, you know, like fucking what, like 12 years after the original. I tell you, this film never gets old to me. And it's one of those films that constantly surprises me each time I watch it because I kind of notice new things just because there's so much going on. And I love kind of that psychotronic, like, exploitation horror where it's comedic, but it's also very serious and it's very, you know, very dark, and it just kind of is really out there. And it really is like a fucking nightmare for, you know, an hour and 20 minutes of this movie. Dennis Hopper's completely 100% over the top and awesome. You know, I mean, Carolyn Williams is like, I can't imagine that she was able to even speak after she filmed this movie, because she just screams so much constantly. And it's just, I mean, it's very effective because it feels like you're right there. You know, Bill Moseley is great. I mean, Leatherface is just completely, again, over the top. All the characters are over the top. But just a really fun, you know, 80s horror flick that's cheesy, scary. I mean, there's some really effective scares in there too. Just the scene where Chop Top, you know, is very first at the recording studio and he's talking to Stretch and like they're going back and forth and she's like, you know, goodbye. And he's like, huh, goodbye. And just they do that exchange and he gets closer. And right in the middle, they're in this dark, you know, corridor, and then they flip on the light and Leatherface's chainsaw is already fucking going. Like as soon as that light flips on, he charges forward. Really effective scare. But just moments like that make this movie a real treat. And, you know, not to get off topic, but, you know, people always complain like, oh, Rob Zombie's movies, everybody's a redneck. Everybody's white trash. Well, that's the movies he wants to make because that's what the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is. That's what part two is. It's that psychotronic exploitation shit. Like Psycho from Texas, Gator Bait, all those films, you know, Poor Pretty Eddie, all those films that we love, those are the movies that Rob Zombie likes. So that's the reason why he uses those characters. And that's the reason why he makes his characters like that. It's not really white trash. It's more or less like a Hicksploitation type deal. You know, because House of Thousand Corpses is his answer for like Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. You know, very colorful, very absurd. You know, the sets for these films. I mean, just Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 alone, when they go into the lair, I want to know who the fuck made that shit. I mean, it is gorgeous. You know, on Blu-ray, it's just all the lights pop. I mean, the sound pops, all the colors. It looks so good. The beads of sweat that are pouring down everybody's face. You know, when fucking Stretch has to put on, you know, LG's face. You know, very reminiscent to the sequence in House of Thousand Corpses when, you know, Otis takes off the girl's father's face and wears it. Kind of the same sequence at all, you know, kind of, they go hand in hand with one another. I think they're kind of a perfect double feature. But it's still a great movie. It always kind of surprises me. It always surprises me how over the top it is. Like, I tend to forget that. So next up was, you know, since I watched it, I wanted to rewatch the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre with Jessica Biel, directed by Marcus Nispel. I didn't like it when it first came out in like 2003. I think it was the year I graduated high school. I didn't really care for it because I was in that mindset of like, no remake's going to be good. So I kind of put it off for years, and I was at Best Buy the other day, and it was like $5, and I was like, eh, you know, give it another shot. Not that bad.
Yeah, it's all
right. It's not that bad. The only complaint that I really had was there's just way too much family stuff going on with all the people that are kind of involved with it. I wish it was more isolated with, you know, kind of Leatherface and maybe a more of a close-knit family, because they're all distant. Like, they really don't interact with one another. You know, R. Lee Remy's character doesn't really associate with all the other characters in the movies until the end. And it's just like everybody's kind of out there, and it's very spotty where they all are, but they're all in on it. And with all these people running, it's just, I don't know. I just wish it was more isolated in the house like the original was, or at least around the farm, and then, you know, dealing with it that way. But it was just too big, you know, running around, and they're always there, you know, somewhere. But I like Leatherface. I thought they did a good job of kind of piecing that character together. Seeing his actual face, I was not a fan of. That was really bizarre, because I don't think you've ever seen Leatherface's face in any other film other than, you know, of course, the masks that he stitches together. But yeah, it's actually not that bad. It's got some great, like, character banter. My only, again, and this is just an issue with horror films, is that why is it we have a group of friends and then as soon as something happens, they're like, oh, fuck them, let's leave them. Like, why in horror films, like, do we do this? Like, you know, there's a possibility that, you know, there's people out there that go through, you know, life-changing events like this, or, you know, an obstacle that they're like, oh, wait, no, we're not just going to leave our friend here because he disappeared. But it's like always that vote. Who votes that we leave? Me. We're not going to leave him. He's my best friend. And then, like, somebody else is like, yeah. And it's like, all right, you guys, like, stay here. We're going to go look for him. It's like, why does this happen? Like, it's just very silly. And growing up and going to the theater and watching these movies, there's always that laugh from the audience of, like, yeah, right. Like, stop doing it. Let people be best friends and go through shit together. And it's probably would add more to the film if there's kind of a camaraderie and a good chemistry between characters. Because once you have that one character that says, fuck them, like, you automatically want them to die.
Right,
and,
right.
I mean, we're going to have people die. But why do we have to have that? It's like just this very, like, and now it's just so normal. And we have to have that. And it just always bothers me. But, I mean, that's just little minor complaints. And then I got around to watching I talked a little bit about Wild Eye last episode. I covered some of the films. Bit. Hey, I had three films.
You covered their entire run.
Hey, I cover a lot of their catalog. I enjoy their films.
We were all going crazy from like exhaustion last week.
Well, it won't be that long. So anyways, I got around to watching Bunny, 58 minutes, no complaints here.
Bunny?
Yeah, it's called Bunny with an I. Basically, a woman that is mistreated comes back in this kind of sexy killer bunny. Well, I mean, she just has rabbit ears on and this white mask face.
That's pretty much any sexy costume, I guess, is just like one piece of like the normal costume.
Well, it was really like, it's so stupid how people are on the internet. I just like clicked just to scroll through like reviews. And I think someone put like, if you like sluts, you'll like this movie. I'm like, what is fucking wrong with you, dude? Like, how is that even anything that comes to your head? Like, oh, if you like sluts, you'll love this movie.
Because she's a sexy bunny.
There's nothing slutty about the girls in this movie. They just wear Halloween costumes that are kind of revealing. But anyways, kind of like, I really liked it, but like some technical aspects, like I don't know what they shot the film on, but it feels like there's every other frame drops in the movie. So it moves really odd. Like it's almost filmed like with an old school, like video, like a camera phone. Like, or phone camera, whatever. But it's very odd because it feels like there's frames that are dropped, or when they like uploaded it to the DVD, like something happened, like they were uploading more movies. So like kind of, it's very skippy, which kind of like takes you out of the movie a little bit. And the audio is a little off, but I mean, this movie was made for like $2,000, like literally $2,000. But it stays true kind of to the, like, kind of the slasher genre, you know, getting to know your characters a little bit, 40 minutes into the movie, then we start, you know, slashing people up, and kind of has, you know, that corny, like, hey, this is why I'm doing it. But for slasher fans that like that type of shit, then Bunny is definitely for you. And it's, like I said, it's 58 minutes.
Wow. That's not even technically a full-length movie.
No, it's not. Well, there's a sequence after the credits, so that's the reason why it's considered a feature, I guess.
Is it a 20-minute scene?
Movies have to only be 60 minutes.
Wow.
To be considered a feature, I believe. So it's 58 minutes of a movie, and then, you know, 37 minutes of credits, and then a sequence. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Next up, non-horror. But I saw this at South by Southwest. Eventually, this is out on VOD now and DVD. Weird that they didn't do a Blu-ray of it, because the music, it's a music documentary, so it's kind of odd that you don't put something on Blu-ray.
Yeah,
especially with fucking loud ass music. I mean, it might be. I just know I have the DVD in my hands. So it's called Breaking a Monster, which it's about this metal band called Unlocking the Truth, where it's three grade school kids that live in Brooklyn, who have a metal band that they perform in the streets. And now, what I really liked about this doc, and I saw this at South by Southwest in like 2015, is that the documentary, because it's three black kids. And one thing I loved about the documentary is very invasive, to the point of like, they asked that question that I was hoping that they would ask. Like, do you think that you gain popularity because your music's good? Or are you gaining popularity because you're three black kids playing metal? Like, I was like, oh, shit. Like, they fucking asked that question. Like, that's really fucking cool, because, like, are these kids really good, or are we just like taken back because it's black people playing metal? And number two, like, I mean, you got to think about it as a metal fan, like how many black artists are there that are playing metal? Well, yeah, I realize that, but I mean, it's
few and far. Those guys kick ass too.
No, I agree.
Living Color in the documentary?
No, it's more
than the documentary's bullshit.
No. It's definitely more about the kids than, you know, why are they gaining popularity? But they do ask that question. I thought that was kind of ballsy. You know, and it's funny because the kids are like, yeah. Like, you know, and I was like, you know, that's an appropriate answer, you know, because like this just life. I mean, especially coming from the metal community. But these kids, man, they can fucking shred, you know, they start as very, you know, just instrumental. And being that their voices are changing, they were learning how to sing. Now, the singing I could deal without. But the music alone was great. And so this documentary is about them starting out from being a YouTube viral video to getting their very first record deal. And I really, really hope these three boys stay together because I think they're going to create something pretty awesome. Because if you can play that well when you're young,
yeah.
I can only imagine what you can do when you're older. I mean,
how old are these kids?
They're grade schoolers.
Damn.
I think they're sixth grade. And like, dude, they can fucking shred, man. Like, you got to think sixth grade. How, you know, Danny's in sixth grade, right?
Yeah.
And Willow's in sixth grade. Like, imagine our daughters picking up a guitar and just playing like solos from Metallica.
Wow.
Like that's what these kids are doing. So you got to
put that in perspective. I'm failing as a parent, apparently.
You know, so, but these kids were doing it beforehand. Like before this documentary was made when they're in sixth grade, they were doing this beforehand. So like all those like crazy videos that you see, like watch this little kid play the drums. Well, that's really cool. But these kids are actually making music together, doing covers, creating their own music now. Like, really, really cool doc. Like I said, very invasive. Kind of touches on, you know, those questions that I said. It definitely brings it up, which I really liked, you know, because confront people. And, you know, I love how the kids react to it because they're like, yeah, but we're actually really good. Like, you know, listen to the music and then people listen to it and they're like, oh shit, these kids are just really great musicians. So really excited to see what happens. And I really want people to see the documentary. So next up was, you know, I was watching this with my daughter, which I was really excited about. I know I text you about it, but Hideo Nakata's follow-up to The Ring, he did a movie called Dark Water in 2002. This was released by Arrow on Blu-ray recently. You know, as you know, Hideo Nakata did The Ring, which was, you know, a sensation in Japan. It eventually floated its way over here on bootlegs, and then within like 3 years, we got a U.S. remake, which is still one of the best horror films, I think, in the past, like, 30 years.
Is Ringu on Blu-ray right now?
I don't think so. But I'm pretty sure with them doing Pulse and Dark Water, I think they got a hold of kind of like the Media Blasters, Tokyo Shock, Magnolia's titles, because I think Pulse is a Magnolia title. So I think they're going to go through and hopefully release line of J horror films,
dude. If Arrow releases like a collector's edition, awesome edition of Ringu, like boner for days.
I hope they do the trilogy. I think Ring 2 is a lot better than the original Ring. We're talking about the J horror titles
now.
That American bullshit.
the first remake was decent. The Ring 2 was awful.
If they just would have stayed true to the original film,
yeah,
like it would have been a lot cooler. Fun fact about the original film, there's actually two sequels to the original. They made at different times, one Korean, one Japanese. Huh. The other one's called Spiral. Both still really good. So Darkwater is kind of a different take, I think, on J-horror. Because, you know, I popped it in and I was like, I saw it, you know, probably 15 years ago. And then, you know, the Jennifer Connelly remake came out. I saw that in theaters. So I was like, whatever. I'm always a big fan from like 95 to like 2003 J-horror. I really love it, even though it's kind of the same, like, ghost girl in all the films. I think the suspense buildup and the amount of dread that's pouring through these movies is something that can really get your heart beating. And that's kind of how I feel with these films. Darkwater kind of does that, but is so much more of a drama. And I didn't really catch that, I guess, the first time when I watched it. But I'm digging the movie, but I look over at Willow towards the end of the film, and it looks like the apartment building is in her eyes. It's just flooded with water. And she looks over at me with this fucking teary-eyed face, goes, and just like kind of gets mad at me, saying, "You said this is a horror movie, not a sad one." And I was like, yeah, this movie is kind of sad.
Yeah, it's more of a drama. Like, the whole story is very much a drama.
So, yeah, it's about this little girl and her mom. It's weird because she's like kind of a proofreader for comic books, which was kind of a cool, like, job for, you know,
this job.
Lady from Japan, you know? So, anyways, they're trying to move along with their lives. They move to an apartment building, soon to find out that the apartment above them on the next floor, there's kind of a water leak that's coming through their roof. And slowly they realize, because the little girl keeps on going up to the roof, finding this red bag, that there is a little girl that is kind of haunting the building. And she wants somebody, you know, a lonely ghost type story. And then it kind of goes from there, you know, dealing with the little girl and the mom's emotions and, you know, trying to figure out if she's crazy or not, having people call her crazy and trying to decide if she is crazy or if there really is a ghost that's haunting their building. But a really effective, you know, it looks fine on Blu-ray. It's definitely better than the Asian Tartan Extreme DVDs that came out, of these movies and all the bootlegs. I don't even know who officially released this because there were so many goddamn bootlegs of J-horror films. But it looks good. It's very grainy, which I'm not sure is part of the filmmaking process or if it's just what Arrow had to deal with, because they don't mention that there's any transfer of film. They just say a high definition transfer to digital transfer. So that's what usually means it's a HD master when companies say that, but it still looks good. They definitely played with it and tweaked with it. A solid J-horror film. If you like that stuff, it's not as wacky. Let's put it that way. It's not as wacky as your normal, like, you know, Grudge Ring film, even though there's like 16 Grudge films. And this is another film that you mentioned earlier, Sean, and I have the Blu-ray of it in my hand.
Oh, shit.
So I rewatched after, what, fucking, I don't know, 13 years when this came out? Oh, 10 years. Pan's Labyrinth. Came out on Criterion Blu-ray. Del Toro's, you know, kind of childhood horror fantasy film. I saw this in theaters, and I haven't seen it since. A beautiful film, number one, but a great story, a very brutal story. And that's what I really liked about this film, is that Del Toro is telling a, you know, if you took like Neverending Story and Crawl and Labyrinth and Dark Crystal, but you made it really brutal. Yeah. That's kind of what Pan's Labyrinth's like, you know, because it's like this childhood fantasy, but there is this big horror aspect. Like, I wish this movie would existed when I was, you know, like 13.
I know.
You know, I think this would have changed my life. It's one of those films. But, you know, I saw it in 2003 and I watched it again with Willow. Because, you know, we're doing the whole horror, you know, October thing. So I figured this would be a good film. She loved it. You know, my biggest complaint with this is why didn't this have a great score? Like, it doesn't have a very good score.
Yeah, like, I don't remember the score. I remember the visuals. I don't remember the
That's what I'm saying. Like, I remember how beautiful the film is, and it still holds up, and how, you know, haunting it looks, and the creature effects, and just the father, the general. Is he a general, or is he just I think he's a general. But just how brutal he is. I mean, he bashes a guy's face in with a fucking beer bottle and shoots people in the head, like, left and right. So, I mean, I'm sure everybody's familiar with Pan's Labyrinth, so I'm not going to really get into the plot other than, you know, a little girl lives with her mom. They go to a compound where this general lives because the mother had a husband that he was a tailor. He died. And the guy who tailored the suits, or the guy that would come in and have his suits tailored, was the general. They fall in love. He moves them out there with him, and you find out this guy is kind of a piece of shit. And the mother's pregnant with his son. And the little girl is trying to find kind of a way out. Stumbles across kind of this fantasy world, this portal, that you know, she doesn't belong in the real world, technically. And it kind of goes from there. A very sweet story, but also not your, like, there's something with, you know, I think even Dark Water kind of goes hand in hand, is that, you know, the Spanish horror community, they love to do, like, really brutal stuff, but have these, like, really, like, dramatic sequences and kind of really, like, they want to say, all right, we're going to stop with the horror for a second and we're going to get real on your ass. That's what these movies do. And by the end of the Pan's Labyrinth, you're like, oh, my God. Like, holy fuck, you know? So definitely pick it up. It's a new 2K transfer that is supervised by Del Toro. So it's definitely the best that the film has ever looked.
God damn, you're going to make me buy this again, aren't you?
Dude, it has a 7.1 new master audio, and it sounds incredible. Like, right, the gunshots, the explosions of all the war stuff, when the fawn creature, like, walks around and he's thudding around. But the one thing I noticed, because it sounds so good, is that this movie doesn't have a good soundtrack. It doesn't have a good score. And that really bothered me, because I felt like this movie would have been amplified, like, twofold if they had, like, some kind of, like, you know, fantasy, like, even though I'm not a huge Danny Elfman fan, if it would have had, like, a Danny Elfman soundtrack to it, like, it could have amplified the film. But I don't know if it's just me. Like, I almost want to rewatch it, because halfway through the film, I was like, where's the music in this movie? Like, the credits have a great, you know, theme, but there's, like, no theme song. I don't know if that's intentional from Del Toro, if he didn't want to focus on that. If he wanted to focus more on the story, then that's obviously, you know, a directorial, you know, standpoint on by him. But I felt like the movie could have used a good score. But it didn't have it. And then last but not least, I think this is last. I think. Yeah. I mean, I'll talk about both films. But Arrow recently – did you pick up the Hills Have Eyes box set?
It is on its way to me from grindhousevideo.com.
Mike needs to hurry up.
Well, he's where I'm waiting. He was in a ship something out for me today, but I told him to hold off until Exorcist 3 arrives, and he's going to be sending all that to me. So cool. I'm being patient.
So holding this box, like, I love Arrow's boxes. Like, the way they feel in your hands, you're not holding something cheaply made. Like, it's like hard cardboard that's not going to, like, you know. Yeah. They don't do that, like, well, like.
They did that for, except for Bride of Reanimator. They kind of dropped the ball on Bride of Reanimator.
Yeah, yeah. I wish they would have done that box. But I think they learned their lesson, because it's not where those kind of folded in boxes. Like, this is a hard, like, duty cardboard.
Yeah, I love
like boxes. There's no bending this unless you force it. But anyways, Arrow did this is a limited edition, I believe, but they did a 4K restoration of The Hills Have Eyes on Blu-ray. As a long, long, long time fan of The Hills Have Eyes, I've owned this on pretty much every format, from the Anchor Bay 2 disc to the Blu-ray that Image released, to multiple VHS tapes, even having digital files that I've downloaded. I mean, I've always been a huge Hills Have Eyes fan. And seeing this film, like, it was almost watching it for the first time because you actually see shit. But definitely a wonderful, wonderful transfer. So 4K restoration on the film. It looks flawless. But it keeps that, like, old school, like, grainy feel.
Yeah,
like,
it's a pretty dirty looking movie.
Like, yeah, yeah. It's just, it still looks dirty, but you can actually see how dirty it looks, that type of thing. But I mean, I'm not going to talk about the plot. You know what it is. A bunch of cannibals attack people. There you go. Definitely some really, really great work that was put into this film. You know, a great booklet as well. I don't really usually read booklets, but Arrow, I tended to, because they usually have people that know what they're talking about. And Ewan Cant, who brings a lot of this stuff to the table, has this really great article focusing on kind of The Hills Have Eyes, like, as a whole. So we're talking about Hills Have Eyes, The Hills Have Eyes Part 2, The Hills Have Eyes Remake, The Hills Have Eyes Part 2 Remake, and also the not really official, but official Hills Have Eyes 3 Mind Ripper with Lance Hendrickson. He goes into all that in great detail and kind of covers the entire franchise. Does a really great job. Very, very great writer. It has, of course, a poster, postcards, all that bullshit that they usually put in there. And they pulled the old Anchor Bay documentary on it, which I was really, really happy about, because that was my only kind of, because I think it was lost on the Image disc. So I kept the two-disc DVD from Anchor Bay, because I don't remember. I just kept, because I usually do that, because I say I kind of contradict myself and sound like a hypocrite now, is that there's certain things that I look for. Like, anytime Wes Craven has to speak, I'm always there. Like, I just love his voice. I love the way he tells stories. He's a great storyteller. So I didn't want to miss that interview piece documentary. And they put it on there. It's called The Hills Still Have Eyes. And they also have a bunch of new shit with, Peter Locke, who kind of supervised this whole thing, which is Wes Craven's producer on the film. So a really, really great set. And, you know, just very well put together. And also has the alternate ending, which I have never seen. So even of all these things I have, I never saw the alternate ending. So watching the film, again, I watched this with Willow. This was our late night movie. Like, I shouldn't have school this past Monday. So we stayed up late and watched it, and she had the same reaction I did when I very first saw it. And when it ends, I'm like, wait, is that it? Like, are we done? Like, did we just end the movie like that? And she was like, man, what a ripoff. Like, what happens to the family? And I was like, I don't, you know, that's just how the film is. I mean, there is a continuation, but it's like, it doesn't even feel like part of The Hills Have Eyes. You know, like the original with the sequel that Craven did. But, you know, we dug into the alternate ending. it's not really much of an alternate ending, which I thought was pretty funny. All they do is they flip-flop the scenes where, you know, Bobby and his sister kill Jupiter. They put that last instead of having, what's his name, David go after his daughter, and where he meets, like, when he goes to kill Mars, because the ending is him killing Mars. Mm-hmm. But he gives the baby to Ruby to, you know, run off with so he can, you know, kill Mars. And it ends with that. Well, all they did is they flip-flop it. They put him killing Mars first, and then they put Bobby and his sister killing Papa Jupiter. And then it ends. The only alternate ending is that they show the remaining survivors together, and Ruby and the daughter holding hands. And then, like, Beast is, like, licking their hands, and it ends. Which, it works when you're going into the sequel, because there's always that question of, like, wait, why is Ruby, like, around in the sequel? But, you know, obviously the family takes her in because of her help. But just it's a weird sequel to boot. I know a lot of people have a lot of beef with the sequel to Hell's Have Eyes. But as a standalone film, I think it's extremely effective. It's very mean. And it's unlike stuff. You got to think, like, was this 1977? Like, I mean, you have fucking Craven making Last House on the Left in 72, which is probably about 20 years before its time. Well, let's just say 10 years, because the 1982 shit would have been made like that, like, all the time. So probably about 10 years before, like, it was probably due for the world to see. And then 77 with The Hills Have Eyes, where he got a lot of flack on that, too. Just because of how mean The Hills Have Eyes is. Yeah. But Craven didn't overdo it, which I really enjoyed, because Last House on the Left is relentless. I mean, it is fucking brutal. It's really fucking dirty. You know, just the rape sequence when Krug is carving his name into the girl's chest.
Yeah.
Like, it's just really, really tough. In The Hills Have Eyes, he does allude to more sinister things happening, but he doesn't go and show it too much. And that's what I really liked. Now, Aja was like, oh, fuck it. I'm going to actually do the rape scene in the remake of The Hills Have Eyes. But, you know, you don't really get to see that, because it would take you out of the movie, because so much shit is happening during that sequence. Like, that's what I really love about the film, is that it gets so chaotic, because they're burning the father. They're trying to run outside. You know, Dee Wallace and her mom are trying to defend the place with the baby. The sister's in the back getting attacked by Pluto. And, like, people are left and right gone. You know, and it's like, oh my God, like, these people really know how to throw chaos in order to get what they want. Like, they obviously have been doing this for a long time. Whether that's kind of the direction and, you know, the motivation behind that sequence from Craven, but he really knew how to make you feel uneasy with The Hills Have Eyes. But it's what he does in all his movies. Like, not, well, aside from The Music of the Heart, but, you know, he's really good at making things so real. Even Last House on the Left, even Scream, Hell's Have Eyes, Nightmare on Elm Street, they have this, even like how bizarre the plot to Nightmare on Elm Street is, it's very, like, it feels very real to me. Like, yeah. You know,
yeah.
And they ruined, and the reason why I don't really care for the sequels is because they made Freddy a comedian. And the first film, he is a comedian, but it's very, like, down-to-earth type. Like, where he's just saying really fucked up things rather than making jokes. I think that's the big difference.
Yeah, it gets very pop culture-y as it goes on. He's making right. All these pop culture jokes. All right, man. Well, do you have anything else?
No, man. I think this is a great set, and it's fairly cheap too. So definitely pick it up, because it's like it's like $25 or something.
Yeah, for a set like this, I was surprised.
Grindhouse Video has it for $27.99, which is super cheap.
Yeah.
So it's just the box alone. Like, I mean, And this is the definitive release.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's what I love about these things is because when DVDs were coming out, like we had hints of better quality. You know, even when Blu-ray's coming out, there's not going to be much more than better than 2K and 4K. Like you're just not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like even if it is 8K,
even 4K is
pushing it.
It's pushing it because no one has a gigantic wall they're going to project on. Really, I mean,
right?
4K's. I don't know. I'll go off on this whole UHD thing. I think it's. I don't think it's necessary, but. But yeah, cool. I can't wait for my set to arrive, for sure. Faux show. Let's jump into our interview with Brian Trenchard-Smith, and talking about Dead End Drive-In and more of his films. Let's do that in just a second. But first, we have Josh Obershaw bringing us some news. Josh, what's going on, man, in the world of Blu-ray news? We missed you last week.
I know, and I'm pretty sure there's a lot of people that that miss me too, but I'm back. I'm still alive. May not be as active as I used to be, but
it's okay.
I'm still kicking in. I'm still bringing you some.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's good because you're actually making money. you're being busy making money, which is good. Not you know, working for free on some bullshit.
Hell yeah.
Blog.
Yeah. True. And maybe I could buy more of these hot items that we've been talking about all year. It's going to be a very, very lovely Christmas for me.
Nice.
So why don't we get started? And I want to start off with something that people have actually asked me directly on Twitter about if we were going to cover this. And you bet your ass we're going to cover this because Arrow Video announced that they are bringing Hellraiser, the Scarlet Box, to the United States, and it's coming out on December 13th. Now, for those people who may have heard about the Scarlet Box or don't have a region-free player and maybe are really, really curious about what exactly is in this box set, I'll give you a quick rundown of what it is. What it is a Blu-ray box set of the first three Hellraiser movies, all 2K restorations, a whole bunch of bonus features, a fourth disc, which is entitled The Clive Barker Legacy, which is exclusive to this box set. It contains Clive Barker short films Salom and The Forbidden, Books of Blood and Beyond, the literary works of Clive Barker. Also, Hellraiser Evolutions. This is a brand new documentary looking at the evolution of the hit horror franchise and its enduring legacy, featuring interviews with Scott Derrickson, who did Hellraiser Inferno, Rick Boda, who directed Hellseeker, Deader, and Hellworld, and Stuart Gordon, plus many others. Plus, you've also got The Hellraiser Chronicles, A Question of Faith, which is another short film. Plus, you get a 200-page book, Damnation Games, which is also exclusive to this box set. It has new writings on Hellraiser and the Barker universe from archivists Phil and Sarah Stokes, including chapters looking at Barker's early work, the genesis and production of the first three movies in the Hellraiser series, all illustrated with stills and rare material from the Barker archives. This is a massive, beautiful box set, and I can't wait to get my hands on this one finally.
Yeah,
I haven't made the upgrade to. I know you have this, don't you? You have the import.
Yeah, I got the UK release. The thing that's frustrating with these bigger box sets with Arrow is if they're released region 2 and you can get them through like Amazon UK or from Arrow directly. Generally, these big box sets, even though they're a locked region, I'm hearing like an echo. That's weird. They are generally cheaper if you import it from Arrow UK. Because of what I heard was, I think this was Mike from Grindhouse Video. He said that Arrow manufactures all their discs in the UK, so the shipping charge, the cost of shipping from the UK to the distributors in the US adds an extra charge. It you know, it cuts into the cost. So therefore, these are always going to be a little more expensive in the US. So what I do is whenever there's a box set, since I'm region free, I have a region free player, one of these box sets, if it's UK only, and I know they'll eventually release it in the US, but if I can get it UK only, I don't care. Like, I got the Stray Cat Rock set for way cheaper than the US, you know, what it was selling in the US. Same thing with this. So if you're trying to save money and manage your money, you know, like we all have, this is our, you know, this is our sickness, right? We collect all these things. if you can get these box sets, even if they're region locked, they're from the Aero UK, you're going to save $30 to $40 easy. So that said, I think it's like $98. I mean, it is pricey, but, and they're probably going to release standalones like they did in the UK. If you want to wait and just want this, you know, those releases, they will be cheaper, but believe me, this set is gorgeous. And so you are paying for some of the extras, some of the book, the sexiness of that box. So, you know, weigh all those options. And there's ways to kind of hack buying Aero, box sets, the way that I described. So always keep that in mind. Little helpful tip.
Of course. Especially this time of year when it's the holiday shopping season.
Yeah, and this time of year is when a ton of amazing things get released on Blu-ray.
Seriously, like for instance, our next one that we're going to be talking about is Dario Argento's Phenomena. Synapse is putting out a collector's edition steelbook, which is limited to 3,000 units. This is coming out pretty soon. It's coming out via Synapse, like I said before. I don't know why it went that direction, but it's coming out on November 15th, so it's pretty much less than a month. It's going to contain two Blu-rays, one CD soundtrack, and a collector's booklet in a collectible Blu-ray steelbook, of course. Let's see what the bonus features are going to be on this. Well, first of all, this thing has three different versions of the movie. You've got a 160-minute version, you've got a 110-minute version, and you're also going to be getting the U.S. version, the one known as Creepers,
yep,
for the first time on Blu-ray.
Yeah, the first time I saw kind of Creepers, exciting. The first time I saw Creepers was a burn, you know, from Amazon. Someone was doing like, it was like burn, you know, you're basically buying the burn disc, you know. One of the studios was doing it, and that the first time I saw Phenomena was the Creepers cut.
I have no memory of the Creepers version when I was a kid. So yeah. The first version I ever saw was the Argento version when, what was it? Yeah, Anchor Bay put it out in 2007, 2006. Okay. So that's the first time I ever saw that movie. And I love this movie. So this is definitely one I'm going to be picking up. I mean, I know it's, you know, Synapse Blu-rays, the Steelbook Blu-rays are really, really expensive. But you get bang for the buck. I mean, you get the soundtrack. I mean, it's the original motion picture soundtrack containing the complete 16-track Goblin instrumental score for the movie, along with four tracks from Andy Sexgang and Simon Boswell. What else we got? We got a commentary track on the 110-minute version from Argento scholar and author Derek Botello, and film historian, journalist, and radio television commentator David Duval. You got two completely different sound mix options on the 110-minute version. Dario Argento's World of Horror. This is a documentary, a fascinating look at the early films of Argento, including Phenomena, Suspiria, Demons, Dawn of the Dead, Inferno, and many others. You got trailers. You got the Creepers trailer. Wow. Looks beautiful. I can't wait to own this one.
Yeah, Like, I guess after shipping, it's almost $46.
I mean, yikes, but still. It's fully packed, so I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, this one in Tenebrae, I was considered doing the steelbook. I have the Tenebrae. I really wanted that just for the that documentary, so I'll be picking that just the standard. This one, I don't know. I don't know if they're still going to do a couple discs with the two different versions. I don't know what they would do for kind of the budget version. Tenebrae, they kept all the extra features and everything except for the soundtrack. So, yeah, of course, the Steelbook, but I already have the soundtrack on vinyl, so I'm kind of good there.
Oh, nice.
Beautiful vinyl of it. But yeah, I'll keep my eyes open for this because you can still get, they'll announce the cheaper version, and they're not going to sell, this is 3,000 units. They're not going to sell 3,000 of these. Like, they still have, you still find Demons Steelbooks. You can still find the Tenebrae Steelbook and then this one, and there's all the cheaper versions with all those. So, you know, you don't have to just jump on these. I'm always thinking the budget, right? I'm always thinking, you know, try to keep it cheap if you can. But yeah, I mean, if you can swing that for $6, man, this thing is dead sexy.
Mm-hmm. All right, so moving on, what else we got? All right, we know that Phantasm and Phantasm Ravager are out right now. You can watch them on demand. And actually, Sci-Fi played Phantasm Remastered not too long ago. They were doing a marathon of Phantasm Remastered 3 and 4. They didn't do 2, which we'll get into in a minute.
Yep.
But we do have release dates for Phantasm Remastered and Phantasm Ravager, and that's going to be December 6th. And some of the bonus features that I have listed here for each one, the first movie is going to have a new 5.1 surround sound, plus the original mono track. Thank goodness for that. audio commentary with Don Coscarelli, the director, Michael Baldwin, Angus Scrimm, and Bill Thornbury. Graveyard Cards episode. Not sure what that's about.
Yeah,
interviews from 1970. I don't know. Should look into that. But you also get interviews with Don Coscarelli and Angus Scrimm from 1979. Plus, you get all of the deleted scenes that we saw on the DVD that Anchor Bay put out some years ago will be on this, because there's a lot of deleted scenes. They shot a lot of stuff for this movie.
Hmm.
If they put everything in, it could have been a 3-hour movie, and that's including the stuff they integrated into Phantasm 4. For Phantasm Ravager, we've got an audio commentary with director David Hartman and writer-producer Don Coscarelli, a behind-the-scenes look, some deleted scenes, Funtasm, which is a collection of bloopers and outtakes, and we also got a trailer. And you can pre-order these via Diabolic DVD. So no word yet on when that box set is, except for the fact that the box set has been moved back to sometime next year. And I'm going to say that the reason for that is because they're still trying to figure out the rights to Phantasm 2, which I believe is still currently with Screen Factory.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's probably the reason why the box set is not coming out in time for Christmas, and it's probably the reason why Sci-Fi excluded that particular entry in the marathon they did a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Screen Factor put out a really nice, you know, Blu-ray for Phantasm 2, and I'm wondering if they were trying to secure the rights for the rest of them and just got outbid, you know. I always wonder what goes on behind the scenes there. So, yeah, I'm not sure how much they sign these types of distribution deals, and you know, if in fact they can Willigo can get the rights to 2 and throw that in the set.
Hmm.
You know, I don't know if it's a deal breaker or not. I mean, if it's already out in a really great, you know, edition, you know, getting all the rest would be bonus. But I mean, there are the completists that that like to have everything in one set, you know.
True.
Which would be nice. I mean, I'm considering rebuying all the Mad Maxes because it's all going to be one box set here with that black and chrome version.
Oh yeah.
So I'm one of those people, right? I mean, if the entire series is in one box, I mean, that's just icing on the cake. But we'll see what happens with that. So. Yeah, we'll see, man. I'm interested to see what happens with the Phantasm box set. I mean, if this is the biggest thing I think Wellgo USA's done, so it'll be interesting to see if they're up to the task, because the collectors can be fickle.
Yeah, seriously. All right, moving on. A little bit of a new movie news that's coming out on Blu-ray. We got some updates on the movie Don't Breathe. We got a release date for that. That's November 29th. And we got few little bonus features there. We got some deleted scenes with the director's commentary. We got a commentary with the director, Fede Alvarez, of course. Co-writer Rodo Sayegas. I hope I said that right. And actor Stephen Lane. Plus, we got five featurettes. This is actually a lot of bonus features for a new release. I mean, whenever there's a new horror film that comes out on home video, bonus features are pretty light. So I'd say this is kind of a healthy dose.
I think Lights Out did pretty well, actually, for what it was, I think. So I'm excited to see it. Brad had some good things to say about it. So
it didn't come to my town, so I can't wait to see this one. My dinky little redneck town. So we got Scream Factory updates to tell you about. Let me see if I can find them all. Let's start off with Poltergeist. They're releasing Poltergeist 2 and 3, each of them in their own little collector's editions. And they're both going to be available on January 24th. Now, as far as bonus features concerned, the only thing we know as of right now, they're both going to be 2K transfers. They're both going to get slipcovers and newly commissioned front-facing artwork from artist Justin Osborne, who did the artwork for Life Force, The Fog, Child's Play, and obviously they're going to be reversible. So early word on Poltergeist, or at least Poltergeist 2 and 3.
Nice.
I saw Poltergeist 2 recently for like the first time in a lot of years, and wow, is... I can't say that it's aged well, but it is definitely a bonkers sequel, to say the least.
Yeah, both of those are pretty bonkers. So for what they are, they're fun. But I mean, they're nowhere near, the first one. I got them both in like a doubles feature, so I'm not really, I'm not really hankering to have the collector's editions of those. Unless the special features can really, bring a lot to the table as far as the whole series
goes. I think that's good. Yeah, I think that's going to be the deciding factor for a lot of people, especially 3. I want to know more about 3 more than I do want to know about 2. 3 is
the one
two.
In the like high-rise type apartment building, right? Or hotel or something?
Yeah, it's the apartment complex. Yeah, basically the Die Hard of the Poltergeist series, if you want to put it that way. Also, we got some news on David Cronenberg's Rabid. They're going to be putting that out. Screen Factory are going to be putting that out on November 22nd, and the special features for that include 2K scan from the negative at director David Cronenberg's preferred aspect ratio. New audio interview with author Jill C. Nelson. A new Young and Rabid. It's an interview with actress Susan Roman. Audio commentary with writer-director David Cronenberg. Commentary with William Beard, the author of The Artist as Monster, The Cinema of David Cronenberg, an archival interview with Cronenberg, which is always nice, interview with executive producer Ivan Reitman, an interview with co-producer Don Carmody, From Stereo to Video, a video essay by Calum Vanstall, author of They Came From Within, A History of Canadian Horror Cinema. So this is definitely going to be sought after by the Cronenberg people, because Rabbit is that one is a wild movie.
Yeah, I have the error release, so I've been meaning to break that open.
This is definitely in need of a revisit for sure. Oh, well, of course. I mean, if you're going to have news about Rabbit, of course, there's going to be news about Dead Ringers.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be putting that a week before Rabbit. That one, Dead Ringers, is coming out November 15th. And it's going to be a two-disc set. We got a high-definition transfer of the movie, a new audio commentary with writer William Beard, audio commentary with actor Jeremy Irons. Score one for Scream Factory. Disc 2 has a 2K scan at the director's preferred aspect ratio. Carrie Story, an interview with Heidi von Polesk. I hope I'm saying that right. Sorry. Apologies if I butcher it. We got a new interview with Stephen Lack. Connecting Tissues, an interview with special effects artist Gordon Smith. Double Vision, an interview with director of photography Peter Suchitsky. Vintage interviews with Jeremy Irons, Cronenberg, producer Mark Boyman, and co-writer Norman Snyder. A vintage behind-the-scenes featurette and the original trailer. And that slipcover looks... You want to talk about damn sexy. That is the cover, the new cover for Dead Ringers.
Yeah, it's really good.
So, moving right along, we've got an update from Jim Warnowski. He's working on a Blu-ray of the movie Hard to Die.
Mm-hmm.
It's his NC-17 straight-to-video movie. He just announced this on his Facebook page that he's hard at work on it. We don't have, a release date or anything like that, but he said he's hoping that this will be out at some point in 2017. And apparently, it uses some of the same actresses and plot points as the Sorority House Massacre series. So is this Sorority House Massacre 3?
Yeah, it's kind of considered that, yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's more of a riff on Die Hard, but it's technically it would be a Sorority Massacre House Massacre 3.
That is really weird. I gotta check this out then.
I can't wait for it.
Oh wow, it sounds nuts. And finally, we're gonna be taking a look at Vinegar Syndrome. Now, I haven't seen anything about their November package. I'm on their website right now, and I don't see anything in it. But we've got a look at some. Exactly, but well, why don't we take a look at what's coming a little bit sooner first?
Okay, fine.
Keep everyone in suspense. They're going to be putting out a Blu-ray DVD combo of the movie Death Machines. And it's going to be 4K from its original Techniscope camera negative. And the bonus features will include... It's going to be region-free on both formats. So that's good. Scan to restore in 4K. Director introduction, video interview with actor Michael Chong, audio interview with actor Joshua Johnson, some trim, some outtakes, a reversible cover art. And I'm not seeing a release date for the November package, but oh yeah, here it is. It's going to be November 29th. So it's going to be at the end of the month, like all of their other monthly packages.
Yeah.
Next up, they're releasing a double feature Blu-ray DVD combo of the first and second sequels to Taboo. So yeah, this is porn. Moving on. I don't know. I still haven't seen Taboo, so I don't know much about the sequels, but they are going to be region free. They're going to be 2K restorations from 35mm Volt Elements. There's going to be a video interview with actor Blake Palmer. We've got the original theatrical trailer for number 2. We got Kay Parker's personal script for number 3 and reversible cover art. Okay, so now that we got that out of the way, let's get to our sneak peek at December. Vinegar Syndrome has already up for pre-order a lenticular cover for their upcoming Blu-ray of Jack Frost.
Nice. It's actually, they're going to be putting it up for pre-order over their Black Friday weekend sale. So you have a limited time to grab this lenticular. And it's not a slipcover. It's basically like just a lenticular, I don't know, like I guess you can put it inside the plastic or whatever in front of the cover. So it's not technically a slipcase, but it's so cool looking. So November 25th and through the 28th, this lenticular cover will be able to be pre-ordered. I think you're buying the cover with the Blu-ray itself, so the whole package. So you have a limited time to grab that, which is fun.
Oh yeah, it's a fun little Black Friday giveaway that they're having. I mean, especially, Jack Frost. I mean, first we got Hobgoblins. Now we got Jack Frost Christmas.
Yeah, what a time to be alive. I love Jack Frost. It's such a goofy horror flick. And I've only seen this on, like, kind of crappy, like, DVD transfers, you know, full frame, just crappy transfers. I can't believe we're going to see this, you know, in 1080p, like, the proper aspect ratio and everything is going to be, you know, 2K scan. I mean, I never thought I'd see the day that I would see this, you know, with this type of release. Man, it's pretty great. Yeah, pretty excited for it.
And there's a bunch of bonus features for this title too. I mean, it's region free, of course, for both formats. You got a commentary track with the director Michael Cooney, a video introduction from Cooney, a video interview with lead actor Scott McDonald, a video interview with the DP Dean Lentz, and of course the lenticular artwork and also some English subtitles. But that's a lot of bonus features for, you know,
for Jack Frost.
For fucking Jack Frost.
Oh, man. So great. So excited. I saw this the other day when they were kind of teasing it and somebody kind of let the cat out of the bag. And I was just like, oh, my gosh. You know, like, you know, I mean, yeah, it's great. If you haven't seen Jack Frost, remedy that. Or, you know, just buy this and believe us. This is it's a goofy movie about a killer snowman. What perfect way to bring in Christmas than this flick, for sure. Now we just got to get Santa's sleigh out on Blu-ray, and you know, I'll have some.
Oh, perks. you mean with fucking Goldberg?
Yeah. Then we're talking some really great holiday horror. What a goofball of a film! The movie's not that great overall, but like the opening sequence is just fantastic.
That's the best part of the movie.
Yeah,
that is for sure the best part of the movie.
All right, man.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, with that, Merry fucking Christmas. And that's all the news that I have for you this week. Hopefully I'll be back next week with some more fun stuff.
Yep.
And some more good news about some great holiday releases, such as Jack Frost.
Heck yeah. Yep. We'll be taking a break next week, so I will be on vacation. So the following week we will be back, and I'm sure there'll be a lot more. Before we get into this interview here, I do need to give a shout out. Brad and I were on the Horror Dork podcast with Anthony and Mr. Sir. We were just kind of randomly, it worked out that we were going to be guests on there, and Brad set it up. So pretty good guys, and worth checking out. I don't know if they do it like every single night or something like that, but it was live. So it was, a first for me to do something live. I'm used to, you know, editing out all my freaking, you know, tongue ties and mistakes and dead air. And they were having some technical difficulties. So me and Brad were just sitting there and it's live and we're just like, you know, hello. And so we introduced the show. We said, welcome to Horror Dork with Sean and Brad. You're listening from the Screamcast. But it was pretty fun. I was only on it for about an hour because I had to take care of you know, parental stuff. But Brad stayed on for the whole 2-hour gig. So check that out. It's over at blogtalkradio.com/horrordork. If you want to hear that conversation, they kind of cover the whole. We talk movies. We talk how the podcast started and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I think it's my first time guesting on a podcast. No, actually it's not. I was on another podcast before. All right. So check that out, blogtalkradio.com/horrordork. You'll see it'll say Sean and Brad from the Screamcast. All right, Josh, thanks so much, man. Good to talk to you. Talk to you next time.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you again. And I'll see everybody when I see you.
Very honored to have with us on the show the director of Dead End Drive-In, Brian Trenchard Smith. Good afternoon, or good morning. Good afternoon. Right, it's afternoon for Brad and morning for
it's
me.
It's afternoon for me and morning for you guys.
Yes. Yes, it's a gloomy, rainy morning here in the hills above Portland, but very nice it is too. So, hi. Well, thank you for your interest. I'm flattered.
Well, Arrow recently released Dead End Drive-In on Blu-ray, and they gave it, as usual with their releases, you know, the deluxe treatment. And this is one of your films that I hadn't seen yet, and I was really excited to kind of dig in and watch this. And I was expecting kind of just a, you know, post-apocalyptic kind of genre pick. And the thing that I most kind of grabbed onto, especially during this like political season, was like, is like there's actually a deeper layer to this film that I wasn't expecting. Yeah. And one of the first things I, just because I'm a political nut, I'm always focusing on this stuff, and that's what I noticed. But was that something originally that was in the script that was brought to you, or that you got involved with at first, or when did that level of the film kind of get injected in there? Was it always there?
It's the film was based upon a short story written by a Booker Prize winner, Peter Carey, and it was known as Crabs. And that's the name of our hero, who thought he had crabs once, but he didn't, but the nickname sort of stuck. He's just a regular guy, perhaps not particularly bright, and he's living in a society that hasn't suffered an economic, breakdown. It's not full on Mad Max post-apocalypse yet. But it's, it's not been a nuclear, it's not broken down because of some kind of external catastrophe. It's, society, and the economy has imploded, and, the government, have found a way to deal with rampant youth crime coming from rampant youth unemployment. Let's say you've got 50% unemployment, you're bound to have crime. So they have converted the drive-in movie theaters into benevolent youth concentration camps for the unemployed. Anyone who goes into the drive-in and claims the vastly reduced ticket price for the unemployed somehow never leaves. They take the wheels off their car or just a sufficient number of wheels for the car can't go, and that car then becomes their home. But they're given, free junk food, no health food in the cafeteria, drink, drugs, the girls are put on the pill, they're given an issue of blankets, most of the inhabitants in the drive-in, are really quite happy to be there because, life out there on the streets with warring gangs picking over the scraps that society have left, it's no fun. So this isn't too bad. You've got violent movies on the screen at night. You've got music videos playing in the cafeteria. And you can pretty much do anything you like. So for most people, it's great. But it's certainly better than what they had. But for our hero, it was, he had a job. He had a life. He had, a mother that, he lived at home with his mother and his big brother. So he wants to get out. So he represents that independent spirit in all of us who doesn't want to be caged. So the essence of all that was in Peter Carey's short story. But the kind of social nuances that I sort of layered in later working with the writer, were, that they, I sort of made them more overt. Tends to be my way. I tend to be a little bit of the overt school of signposting, so I just wanted to make a few things clear. I knew that there could be some issues with the audience because I was being socially critical of my target audience. This was intended as some kind of youth exploitation flick. And I just had fond memories of some of those youth exploitation flicks of the late 60s and early 70s. I mean, take a film like Wild in the Streets, for instance. That had a strong social message. And, you know, in that one, the old people were being put into old persons concentration camps, and they were all given heavy drugs and they were walked around like zombies. You know, anyone over 30 was considered to be old. So there was an interesting riff on, you know, ageism gone crazy in that film, way ahead of its time. So there were a number of, let's say, Roger Corman-esque exploitation films of the late 60s and early 70s that had social issues at their core. But the audience, you know, had the pill was sugared for them by the sort of stuff that drive-in audiences would go and see. You can go back even further to the early 50s and the monster pictures and the, you know, the alien invasion pictures. It all represented a fear of nuclear war. Mm-hmm. Being manifested in, you know, various different metaphors. So I think it's important to try and have an issue at the core of a film like this. Probably the least popular issue was, you know, the issue of racism. Mm-hmm. You look at what's happening in America today and how immigrants and, you know, the others, mm-hmm, are being blamed for the country's woes by, a populist demagogue, have knee-jerk responses to what they perceive as their own unjust deprivation. So, I did sort of ramp up the issue of, would feel that they are more deserving of, of the handout that the drive-in represents, and how they feel threatened by people of a different color and a different culture, coming into their drive-in. You know, right. This is for white people. There are too bloody many of them, you know, and there's, you know, many of those sentiments are expressed. So I thought that you have to look at what happens when, you know, yeah, so the social norms are suddenly overturned, and how people can, you know, react, in a very primitive way, and it becomes tribal.
Right.
And we're seeing, we're seeing a bit of that today.
Well, that's the part that was the part of the film that was really, like, poignant to me, because, you know, I'm thinking, like, when this movie was released back in was it the late 80s?
It was released. I shot it in 85.
Okay.
It was released in 86. At Christmas. It was Christmas 85. Live in Australia, and then it was released by New World in 86.
What was interesting to me was, like, back then this seemed a little more ramped up, but today it was like, I feel like we've just gone through this, like, this past year. That type of fear just in the populace, you know, right now. Do you feel that way, or is this something that's, you know, that you were seeing even at the time when you were filming this?
Well, I wanted the racial component to be there because of what I witnessed as the reaction to the Vietnamese boat people.
Okay.
Coming to Australia, trying to in large numbers, and being, you know, having a much more compassionate response from the Australian government at the time, which, you know, was a Labor government initially, and, you know, I think there were people in Australia who felt a sense of guilt about participating in the Vietnam War at the request of America, and felt that it was an immoral war, and so there was, in the political climate, I think, of the 70s. You know, a will to do something to help, you know, the wreckage that war had cost. So the racism espoused in the drive-in was directly based on and inspired by the protests that there were to the number of Vietnamese refugees that were being settled in Australia. And of course, naturally, people of a different culture want to be, you know, they feel safer living with their own. So there were enclaves of Vietnamese, and one particular suburb was Cabramatta. The suburb of Sydney, Cabramatta, became a Vietnamese enclave. And that was resented by the sudden takeover, culturally speaking, of that region. You know, lots of, you know, Asian restaurants and so forth, and Asian neon signs and so forth. So there was, you know, there was a reaction against that. So that's where that came from. But it's a timeless problem, and we're seeing it happen today.
I think it's awful, but yet amazing that even that what era you're in, what year racism is always relevant and it never changes. That's something that always got me, even with movies today, even Dead End Drive-In, just even stuff like, you know, from the 60s, it never ever changes. It's just always there, and kind of a shame, but it's nice to see filmmakers voice themselves and voice world problems through cinema, through art, to kind of have a wake up call. So yeah, it's always relevant, which I, like I said, it's a shame and amazing at the same time.
Yeah, but here it's done in such a entertaining way, and that's what I really, really dug about Dead End Drive-In, was with the style, the sets, the neon, the music. Like, it's still very much somewhat of an exploitation film in a sense. With all these undertones, you know, that's, I think I was really surprised. Like, I was just sitting down last night to watch it for the first time, and I was just like, well, you know, this will be just a fun little, you know, 80s exploitation, you know, Ozploitation type flick. And, all this caught me off guard, and I couldn't take my eyes off it. I loved it. And, but I understand the reaction back when it came out in the theaters was a little bit different. Did the audience feel kind of bait and switched, or what was the reaction?
Well, yes,
that you saw?
There were two issues. Initially, the, you know, somewhat conservative distributor who had agreed to take it on in pre-production, and thought that it would be, you know, just a harmless, you know, youth flick, was, you know, they hated it. They absolutely hated it. And initially, the Australian censor wanted to give it a restricted rating. Could only be shown to the over 18s. We appealed, and we were able, without having to make any cuts, because there's nothing really offensive in the visuals. The violence isn't excessive. The brief moment of sex and nudity is well within the bounds that were allowed at that time for what was in Australia an M rating. Sure, but no restriction on entry. And it boiled down to the fact that the negative values that we were castigating, I suppose, in the film, you know, they felt it would encourage those negative values. It showed, you know, youth just having one long party in the drive-in with drink and drugs and they kind of misunderstood the whole point. But we were able to get an unrestricted rating on it, but the distributor hated it. And I think that must have communicated itself to the media. And at that point in Australian cinema, I think the media was beginning to, was turning against, very obviously foreign-influenced commercial movies. I mean, this was perceived as just a sort of Australianization of some a piece of American nonsense. and critics and you know media personalities looking to advance their profile wanted to take the high road and say, you know, we should be making films about the positive aspects of our culture or our history, etc. So it got pretty much uniformly bad reviews, which, you know, I think were people were very unfair. I think to Ned Manning, who you know played the young lad, and I think he played him very well.
Yeah.
He was a very recognizable type, but so it was, you know. If it was praised, it was you know damned with faint praise. Other critics said, "Well, you know, we were expecting lots more action. Where's the action?" You know, but of course, that was not really what the film was about. It's a mood piece,
mm-hmm.
and with sudden bursts of action, and particularly the finale and the amazing you know truck junk stunt. But so yeah, the distributor in Sydney opened the picture in a multiplex that was still under construction, and people I knew had difficulty finding which screen it was on. You know, there was scaffolding around the side of the theater. That didn't help. So it was considered to be justifiably a commercial failure, And swiftly went to video. In those days, there had to be a sort of one year holdback
mm-hmm.
To protect the theaters and drive-ins. But the drive-ins were virtually dead by then. I mean, we used an abandoned drive-in. However, when the film was bought by New World, they saw more in it than than let's say the Australian distributor did. We got an excellent review from, you know, Variety, a very good review from Hollywood Reporter, and a fantastic review by Michael Wilmington of the LA Times. I think he's shifted papers now, but he's in Chicago. But he really got it. And, that caused people to, you know, not to see it so much in the theaters, because it was basically bought to be a filler that would get some visibility through a very fast theatrical release, but the big money was going to be in the VHS release in 1986, which you know I think the direct to video that was a boom market in those days. And if you had been released theatrically on top of that, that helped your profile in the video shops. So it was from that it built its following, which has resulted in Arrow, doing this Blu-ray. No one in Australia, wanted to do a Blu-ray.
Huh.
Even still this day?
I mean, it's out there on DVD. I mean, after the VHS, when everything got up-resed to DVD.
Right.
But it was just a throwaway. But by then, you know, the younger media, pundits were beginning to get it, and it was beginning to get online. In the early 2000s, a bit more of respect. And then when it featured in Mark Hartley's wonderful documentary, Not Quite Hollywood. Have you ever seen Not Quite Hollywood?
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, that's what I actually first had heard about this film was through that documentary. I've been slowly kind of tracking down a lot of those films. It's a great documentary.
I think Quentin Tarantino had seen it when he was working in a video shop in Manhattan Beach, and he had seen a lot of my films that had come, you know, ended up in you know the VHS sections, he remembered it. So when he was interviewed for Dead End for Not Quite Hollywood, he certainly really praised it, which was nice. Yes. So it's built its following and. But you know, no one, you know, I am sure now someone will try and will offer to license the Blu-ray from Arrow and release it in Australia, because you know the work has been done,
and
it's cheaper now to license it than to have to start from scratch. And certainly, I have another Blu-ray coming out on October the 25th, and that is The Man from Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen The Man from Hong Kong?
Yeah, I've seen pretty much, I think, every one of your feature films. The only things that I'm probably slacking in are some of your earlier documentaries.
Man from Hong Kong is Blu-ray, and then there are other early works of mine, which date from 1973 through to 78. My first independent film, when I left Channel 9 Australia and went independent, formed my own company, I made a 50-minute TV special called The Stuntmen, which was where I first recruited and Grant Page and then managed his career, his stunt career for the next 5 years. So the Stuntmen is there, Kung Fu Killers is there, which is a dramatized documentary about how, you know, Grant went to Hong Kong to see who would succeed Bruce Lee. Incidentally, we were told, the name Jackie Chan came up, but people said, no, his first film was a failure. He's never going to make it. Yes, experts.
Wow. Yeah,
gotta love them. So there's the Stuntmen, Kung Fu Killers, Death Cheaters, which was a whimsical action comedy that I made for $150,000. Which is a bit of a miracle. Death Cheaters and Danger Freaks. Danger Freaks was a series of one-hour specials, again, just building on the success of The Stuntmen, and being a vehicle for Grant Page to demonstrate every, you know, single kind of stunt, along with you know, buddies of his, Max Aspin particularly. So I eventually took those 4 1-hours and cannibalized them into a 90-minuter, which is on the Omnibus edition. And then there's Stunt Rock, so all those are on one Omnibus edition, which can be acquired from Umbrella Entertainment in Australia. It's region free.
Yeah, we're big fans of Umbrella. We've talked a lot about their releases through the
they're
through
good.
The years.
We hope to find. Well, we hope to. Well, there's a film of mine that is one of my better films. Really, it's called Frog Dreaming, but it's been very hard to find due to copyright issues. The true inheritors of the copyright, now that the producers and the writer are dead, really want the film to be released, but there are certain, you know, hurdles we have to go through to get the paperwork right. Mm. But Umbrella have released that anyway in Australia as a normal DVD. But it's a beautifully shot film and deserves the full Blu-ray treatment.
That's a film that I actually talk a lot about on this show, because I've always known it as The Quest.
Yes.
So, and also The Go Kids, but yeah, I was always a big chaser. Fan, huh?
The Spirit Chaser as well, and Le Secret du Lac. So there are all sorts of wonderful titles that the film has gone under, and it totally off the subject and the subject of title changes. Do you know what the original title was for Dr. No? Was going to be when the film first was released in Japan. They had a translation problem, and they saved themselves at the last minute. They were going to release it under the title, No, I Do Not Need a Doctor. Anyway, See my trailer from hell on Doctor Who, and you'll learn more.
That's great.
Anyway, titles are wonderful. Gotta love them. And Dead End Drive-In, you know, was a criticized title. You couldn't really call it Crabs because, people might be thinking of crustaceans, large or small. That wasn't going to work as a film title, and we understood that. Dead End Drive-In came up, and we couldn't think of anything better. When you have the words dead end, is that an encouraging phrase? Anyway, a lot of people wondered whether that was the right title, but it's a title that has stuck, and I'm glad the word drive-in is in the title because, you know, there aren't any drive-ins anymore, and this is almost a historical artifact.
Yeah, there's a couple around me here in Southern California, but those things keep closing down. But the people I hear love it when they can go and I actually haven't been, but I keep getting invited to go to these drive-ins because you can see three movies for $10. Mm. You take the whole family and it's fun. So, a shame. It's a shame that they have gone by the wayside.
Yeah, no, it is a pity. I remember I'd never been to a drive-in before I came to Australia. I mean, I'm half British, half Australian, half Irish, and I took a ship to Australia from England when I was 19. And in England, you know, being a cold and rainy place, there were no drive-ins. My jaw dropped when I saw this beautiful drive-in that was, you know, just a few miles away from where I was living. So I did populate it quite a lot. You know, normally people would take their girlfriends, but I just wanted to just go, you know, and see the movie. it was great to, have a hamburger and, you know, to eat while you're watching a movie. I've enjoyed. And the Alamo Draft House has really popularized that, mm-hmm. to eat and drink while seeing the movie. Great.
Yes.
We did try and celebrate some of the interesting aspects of the mechanics of the drive-in. I have done some work as a projectionist when I was a kid, actually, because one of the teachers at the school moonlit. He moonlighted as a projectionist at the local cinema. So I got to be in the projection box and watch how things were done. And looking at and seeing the changeover between one projector when the reel was just finishing to the next projector and how they synchronized those. So as everything is digital now, it's all, you know, I mean, let me go back a bit. You know, films were mounted on 20-minute reels and then, you know, there was a changeover from one projector to the other. Then they brought in the platter system where they joined up all the reels. And of course, when they had to unjoin them and put them back on the original metal reels, you'd lose a frame or two from the ends. Gradually, films, you really notice a blip every time there was a changeover, or what was originally a changeover when films were on the platter system. Now everything is, it's all digital. It's all, zeros and ones. I wanted to show the mechanics of the drive-in. Hence we have a shot of Crabs, you know, trying to find who's stolen his tires, and we have a tracking shot with him as he goes past the projection box. Mm-hmm. And it is at that moment that the projector turns, you know, the left-hand projector goes to the, cuts out, and the right-hand projector turns on at the same time. And this was all done by little cue marks made on the film that the projectionist had to watch and make the switch exactly when he saw the second cue mark. Anyway, it was little bits of, you know, geeky trivia, mm-hmm. like that I wanted preserved And so that people knew what the technology was of the day. Because there's a whole generation now that would have no idea.
Yeah. And that's one thing I also noticed about Dead and Driving was, I mean, especially that tracking shot, but it's, you know, it's you can tell it's not shot fast and cheap. Like, you can tell that there were specific shots planned out, and, you know, especially that shot, it's great. You know, the tracking shot following along.
I tend to shot list the entire film before I start. I may not stick to that shot list, but I like to have the architect's blueprint in my mind, and I like everyone to know more or less what we're going to do. Oh, we're going to do 15 shots before lunch. Interesting. Okay. Well, we can do it in this way, because we're going to cluster a lot of them over there, and then we're going to move over here, et cetera, et cetera. But there is still some flexibility in the plan. But I come from the editorial side of the business, and you know, I started life editing news film at 20, which was great, and then I volunteered to make the station promos because I thought they were dull, and being shy, retiring type, you know that I am, I expressed that, and they said, all right, okay, you have a go. So I did, and naturally I concentrated on sex and violence and helped to lift the ratings on some of these shows. I launched for Channel 9 Australia the original season of Star Trek, which, you know, naturally I packed the promo with violence and special effects.
Right.
So I come from, let's say, you know, from the editorial side, and that the editor, you know, manages the grammar and syntax of the way the story is told visually. So if you know exactly what you want in advance, that will really help. Obviously, there are going to be changes that will occur to you and that will spring naturally out of your interaction with the cast and with your DP. But it's important to have a plan, and then you can use time most efficiently. We had 35 days, split day nights. I wanted a constant late afternoon light to be playing in the daylight scenes, regardless of whatever time of day they were. So we'd often start at 3 in the afternoon and go till 3 or 4 in the morning, sometimes till dawn at 5. The dawn, incidentally, had to be very carefully timed, and the big truck jump stunt was to take place at dawn so that we could see it better. So we actually shot the build-up to it, before dawn or at dawn, and the actual jump itself at sundown. So that's, there was a good deal of planning that went into it. And the whole film cost $2.5 million Australian dollars.
Wow.
Now, that's something I want to ask you. With a lot of your films, they're very contained, but they're very big. Like, you make what looks like huge budget movies, but obviously most of your films, you're on a budget. And with as a filmmaker, you said that you do your shot list, which answers part of that question to, cut down on time and money. But what comes first with you when heading a project, as far as trying to budget it out, or do you budget around the script as you're writing? Because, as a filmmaker, as yourself, everything from like Turkey Shoot to Dead End Drive-In to, even stuff like, your latest Drive Hard, obviously these are all on a budget. So what comes first with you?
Well, generally, the budget range that you're going to be operating in. At the moment, you're sort of handed the script or the idea, or you present an idea or in some cases, you know, a spec script to a potential, you know, investment source, you sort of know, okay, I think we can make this for X dollars. Or I know that this is going to take, you know, 20 days to shoot, to do it, you know, reasonably well. And what I've found, of course, is that then they say, well, we can only afford 18. Or, well, actually, you know, when you say, okay, you can shoot this in three 6-day weeks, well, actually, we can only afford 15 days. So, anyway, then I have to, you know, be really clever about still maintaining the production value of the piece. But generally, you sort of, you know the parameters within which, you're working. So first thing is to streamline the story and, or the number of scenes to, or the number of locations to what you think you can achieve in the given number of shooting days. I mean, Drive Hard, for instance, had to be shot in 18 days, but they had to be 18 10-hour days. In Australia, you work 10-hour days. The overtime is just punitive. You've got 10 hours with a half plus a half hour for lunch. That was quite difficult, let's say. But what made Drive Hard look bigger than its budget was the choice of locations. And the same goes for really every film I've done. This once I've got the storyline down into what I feel is a manageable form for the number of shooting days it will probably get, then I look for the highest production value locations that I can find. I like vistas. Because I grew up on widescreen cinema. I was going to movies in the middle 50s and experiencing, you know, the joys of CinemaScope and 70 millimeter. So, I mean, I'm afraid I have a 70 millimeter brain. Mm-hmm. it just sees things in that aspect ratio. So I'm looking, if you've got a dialogue scene between two people in an office, well, they shouldn't be sitting across a desk from each other. Perhaps there's a reason why they can be walking the corridors, or they can walk out for a private conversation onto a balcony with a vista of the beachfront below them. I look for ways in which I can get spectacle into the photography without, you know, having to pay too much money for it or build spectacular sets. Mm-hmm. I'll use other people's buildings and they'll be my spectacular sets and so on. So it's that's the next approach. So having got the locations, then you look at how you can exploit what they have to offer and place interesting things in foreground, do interesting tracking shots. I love tracking shots. I love camera movement. It just, you know, it is cinema. And so even if I'm making a really low budget television piece, I want to make it cinematic.
It's good to know. I wish other filmmakers took those notes. That's the reason why I asked, because I mean, we have such, you know, big and grand, big budget films, but sometimes they're visually boring. It might be a decent movie, but they're visually boring. At least with your films, you know, even some of your lower budget films, like you said, some of your TV movies, they're at least nice to look at. You know, you always have something going on in your films. And I just, you know, I always see that it inspired, because you look at other directors, other filmmakers, you're always mentioned, which I think is very honorable and awesome. Of course, Tarantino praises you constantly and, you know, even homages some of your films in his films. And how does that make you, like, feel deep down, like, just as far as, like, a, you know, a fanboy, or, you know, just, you know, how does that touch your heart when you see filmmakers do that or say those things?
Well, it does touch my heart. I mean, I think vanity has to play a part in any filmmaker's psychological makeup, because you know, this is a business that is 90% rejection. You know, it's, you have to be, it's very gratifying when your peer group, recognize you. And when Joe Dante, invited me to join the band that do, Trailers from Hell, that was very flattering. And Quentin's, praise for various films of mine in Not Quite Hollywood and other statements he's made when he's introduced pictures, that is very gratifying, because I feel these are people who really understand what it takes to make a film, on slender resources. Imagination, doesn't necessarily have to cost money. Problems can be solved. Logistical problems can be solved without throwing money at, without throwing a vast amount of money, at them. So I am gratified when people get me and when they get my sense of humor, because most of my films, my early films, have a kind of wry undertone. I like to celebrate and, affectionately satirize the genre tropes that go into that particular category or subset of the genre in which I am working. So there's a strong, black comedy vein in an otherwise, reasonably serious film about Vietnam, The Siege of Firebase Gloria. I found, Lee Ermey's sense of his inherent sense of humor when I met him, to be, very, engaging and entertaining. So I encouraged him to bring that out and improvise upon the existing written dialogue. It was in its way also a bit of a groundbreaking Vietnam film that, spoke to veterans and their experience in, certainly in the Tet Offensive. I was able to bring a vein of humor to, a dark subject, that I think made that, made it more effective. Mm-hmm. So, though there are, people who only see my films as just Ozploitation, but there's a vein of humor that I try to bring to these pieces as well. So that is gratifying when people, recognize that. And I have recently turned to, writing a novel, which you may not be aware of. Anyway, here it is. And this is The Headsman's Daughter, which is a time-tripping metaphysical thriller, which also has a strong vein of humor in it. It's, I guess in genre terms, it's Game of Thrones meets Jason Bourne on Freaky Friday. if there are any of my fans out there who would really like me to make another movie soon, and I may well make one or two movies next year, we'll see. It's taken a long time to get a couple of things ready for market. But I encourage anyone who likes my films to go to Amazon or Kindle and buy The Headsman's Daughter, which is, a time-tripping metaphysical thriller that takes place in the 16th century and present day simultaneously via a past life swap. And it's a ripping yarn that is, very evocative of, of, let's say, the pacey action thrillers that I have made, where, with every couple of pages, you've got a cliffhanger, and you've got some in about four different parts of the book, you have a jaw-dropping twist. What? God, now I'm rethinking this. Oh, okay. Get to page 70. Get to page 70. So what I've tried to do, and it's reflected in the trailer I've made for the book, and maybe you'd be so kind as to link the trailer to your podcast.
Yep,
absolutely.
It's on YouTube, The Headsman's Daughter, a book trailer. It's on YouTube and Vimeo. The long one. It's a minute 17.
Okay.
But I've tried to get the audience to understand that I made a sort of a genre mashup in novel form. And so if you like my movies and you like the pace at which things move and the occasional outrageous, surprising events that occur in them, then just read the book and let it play in your mind like a movie. And it'll rock, 248 pages will rock it along. And at the very end, you'll think, ooh, okay, but you know, what happens next? Because while the film, there's the film, you see, I'm doing it myself. The book has closure to its immediate story, but you know, there's more to come. There's obviously, this thing is going to go on. We're just taking a breath.
Nice.
So we'll see. I've self-published, which is, because I had no faith in an existing publisher, getting it out. I really wanted it out in election season, because some of my films, it has a political undercurrent. In this case, I'm dealing with the issue of the, corporate privatization of water, and water, which is a basic human right, and a free access to it. And there are big corporations that really want to, make it a marketable resource. And ultimately, if you can control people's access to water, you can control their behavior.
Right.
So there is a vein of politics running and progressive issues running under the book. But on the surface, like my exploitation films, it's a rip-roaring, a ripping yarn that goes from one roller coaster ride to the next.
Nice. Yeah, well, definitely.
I just did a live purchase, so there you go.
Wow. Now you're talking. Okay.
I love your picture on here, on the book. Do you fence?
Yes. Yes. I've been fencing since I was 13.
Nice.
I captained the school team. I do all three weapons, but yes, frankly, given the fact that I'm now, 104, in Hollywood years, I'm pretty good for an old dog. I frequently find myself fencing against an opponent who is younger, particularly in épée. And after, maybe 30 points or so, or 30 hits, can we take a break? So, okay, fine. Anyway, so I do like fighting.
Nice.
With a sword. There's a genuine adrenaline rush in fencing. It really does feel like combat, where you're not interested in hurting the other person,
mm-hmm.
but you're really interested in getting the tip of your blade onto that target.
Right.
And there's a rush about that. And it doesn't mean that you're a violent person by nature. It's a combat sport like American football, hockey. I've always enjoyed it. It's gymnastic chess, and I recommend it to anybody. And you're never too old to start, or really too young. I mean, young people are starting at 8, I foil is the fastest weapon, and I am regularly beaten by a 17-year-old girl who's going to become, I think, a national champion one day. It's a fun sport. So
yeah.
I have other interests, let's say, than just making film. But I am pretty cinema obsessed.
Yeah.
Well, it has to do with anything.
Sorry?
I was going to say it has to deal with anything of the genres that you attack, because I don't think – I think you've made every type of genre as far as film goes, from comedies. I mean, you did even the Porky's film. You did it's called Pimpin' Pee-wee now, but it's technically
Porky's film. Yes. Porky's well, four. I mean, you must look into the history of that.
Yeah.
But I had to make that in 15 days, just under $500,000. But you know, I'm not daunted by such things. I mean, you can make a film on your cell phone now, and I do take little videos occasionally, and I certainly take pictures and post them on Facebook. And you know, when the deer come back in fall, I'll probably be doing some more of my stuff with the deer. I think it's important to have, a little bit of a life outside of cinema. But somehow, wherever I go, I always see a good location. You know, I go for a walk down the street and I think, ooh, you know, that would look good from over here. Yeah, okay, well, you could have two people walking up and they could talk and then you could just track with them and, oh, you open up another whole vista over there. Oh, that could be good. I'm a sick puppy, I've been obsessed with them since the very first film that I saw. I don't know what it was, but I think I was four and it was projected on a sheet hung on a clothesline between two poles on an airfield in Libya, where my father commanded the particular Air Force base there. And a 16-millimeter projector was projecting what I believe was a Western. Anyway, horses and dust is what I can remember. But the visual image is just... that sort of window into imagination that you could stand or sit there and watch, that always fascinated me, and I've been chasing it ever since.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, I mean, your passion for film definitely shows throughout your filmography. Like Brad said, you've tried pretty much everything. What kind of keeps you coming back to, I guess, like more genre-focused? You know, I mean, you're looking through all your films, I mean, BMX Bandits is one of my favorite films. I love that flick. You did Night of the Demons 2, and then even like the Leprechaun, the later Leprechaun films. Are you kind of wired to kind of go back to genre every time, or is that just kind of the wheelhouse that you enjoy? Or,
well, I think partially it's a matter of what they offer you, mm-hmm. or what you can offer them that they want. I would love to do, maybe a meaningful social drama, mm-hmm. That had real point, an activist film perhaps, though they tend not to fare well at the box office. they tend to appeal only to the converted, mm-hmm. and not the unconverted. You get typed in this business. Executives are, generally, very concerned about losing their job, because once you get, tossed out, it takes a while for you to get back into the circle again. So it's a very risk-averse industry. So people look at my resume, and I've had stars turn me down as the proposed director because, well, he made Leprechaun movies. when you're trying to make Leprechaun in Vegas in 14 days, and steal a night's shooting without permits in Vegas, that takes a bit of doing, but the same skills could be applied to Shakespeare. And the key to being a good director of actors is good casting. So if you have a really good cast and a really good actor is a good detective, that he or she will have, you know, scoured the text for clues as to what makes this character tick. And in discussion with the director, can work on ways in which that can become more obvious to the audience, and then make the character richer. So these are skills that can be applied to high-end drama as well as popcorn genre. But if your career, if your resume lists all this popcorn genre, then people think, well, we can't really trust him with an important subject like this, because there'd be a leprechaun popping up every 5 minutes, or suddenly there'd be a car chase that had no real place in the story. And I guess that's also people in this is a business of star fuckers. They want the biggest name in front or behind the camera to give them security. That's fair enough. That's the nature of the business. I'll give you one film in particular, Happy Face Murders. You haven't seen that, probably. I did four pictures for Showtime. They liked me in one particular management cycle. As soon as that management cycle changed, I couldn't get my calls returned. That's Hollywood.
Right.
It's very feudal, and you depend upon your feudal lords to toss you a campaign to go and fight. And if your feudal lord gets deposed, you better find another one. And I've had a few people who bounce back and say, "I'm back. I've got a deal at such and such a place. Come and help me." But Happy Face Murders, I think, is one of my more interesting, quirky police procedurals that also has a vein of humor running through it, though it's about a real life serial killer, an actual serial killer who's in prison and unrepentant and probably killed at least 8 women. The producers had developed a script that was sort of hovering on the brink. If they could get a director that Showtime wanted, it would be greenlit, and then they'd go out to casting. So I was proposed by an executive at Showtime who liked my work, and they said, "Oh no, he does leprechaun movies. He couldn't possibly direct this with the subtlety that it requires." And I don't think I did actually direct it with a great deal of subtlety, but I think it has a consistent tone nonetheless. However, I won them over and then helped do a draft of the script with an excellent writer, John Pielmeyer. And that draft, which introduced more humor into the piece, won Showtime over, and they greenlit the movie, and we got Anne Margaret to play the lead. We got Mark Helgenberger and Henry Thomas to play the two investigators, and Nicholas Campbell to play, I'll let you find out whether he is guilty or innocent. But it had to be made in Toronto in 21 days. And I think it is an interesting, quirky look at how media and entertainment has an influence over the criminal justice system and over the way people think about the criminal justice system. So I think it's probably something you can get on demand from Paramount, but it certainly had a VHS release. But unfortunately, it was never finished. It was shot on 35, but never finished on 35. So it was finished on Digibeta, and there was never a matched negative. So it'll never make Blu-ray.
Okay, right.
But if you can find it, it's an example of my somewhat quirky vision applied to a standard police procedural.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'll have to check it out. Let me make a note here. Let me put this in here to highlight this. All right. Well, Brian, thank you so much for chatting with us about Dead End Drive-In and your career. It's been, just fantastic hearing your stories about all this. Brad, do you have anything before we close?
Nope, just thank you for making movies, man.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your interest. I'm flat. And thank you for getting The Headsman's Daughter. I promise you a page turner, let's say.
Hey, I've been a long time fan of your film, so if it's anything like that.
What is your favorite of mine?
Turkey Shoot. Next to Night of the Demons 2.
Yes. Oh God. Why didn't they come to me when they wanted to remake the Night of the Demons franchise?
Yeah. I know, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of that. And when I was younger, you know, before I really kind of dove into cinema, you know, all around, I guess I was in my young teens is when I went to go see From Dusk Till Dawn in the theater. And when I saw that sequence where they're gearing up in the strip bar, and then they had the super soaker. I was like, son of a bitch. They ripped that off, you know, but then growing up, I was like, oh no, that's totally what Tarantino does. He loves to show that, hey, this inspired me. And, having that connection in those two movies and, you know, From Dusk Till Dawn also being one of my favorite movies of all time. Like, it's just, they go hand in hand and it's a beautiful thing. But yeah, I would say Turkey Shoot is my favorite, by far.
Yeah, it has a kind of in your face outrageousness, but that's motivated by a lack of money. There was a sudden budget shortfall, shall we say, a couple of weeks before the shoot, and not all the money turned up. But there were a lot of contractual obligations financially to, as we say, above the line. So the shortfall had to come out of the below the line, and suddenly a 40-day shoot had to go down to 28.
Oh, wow.
And a 94-page script had to have basically 12 pages torn out of it. The whole 15-page 1984 sequence in which the lead characters were captured had to go, and we had to start at the prison camp. This film tested my editorial skill, let's say, because I had to find ways in which to layer in that backstory as we were shooting. The brief scene where I'm clubbing, Steve Railsback over the head in his flashback, and, where Olivia Hussey is, wrongly accused of being a sympathizer and arrested by our stunt coordinator because I had to use available people, and how do I get a sense of the future outside of the camp? Well, God, okay, I'll put it in a jewelry shop and shoot it real tight. All of those scenes had to be shot in the last 4 hours of our 28th day.
Wow.
Just to provide a little bit of backstory. And then I came up with the idea of doing an opening title full of news film of riots and the violent suppression of protest. I'm quite proud of the way I designed that multi-panel split-screen sequence. I always liked, multiple panel films like Mad Dogs and the Englishman, that took 16mm and doubled images and so forth. So that title helped. But the final challenge was, how do I blow up the prison camp? We'd committed ourselves to the explosions. We didn't have as many huts to blow up as we originally wanted. We could certainly blow it up, but what was going to blow it up? Because no longer are we going to get a whole bunch of helicopters strafing and bombing and, doing a bit of a Vietnam thing. But I scoured the woods, so to speak, for 35mm stock footage, and found it in a government, a Royal Australian Air Force documentary about the Mirage jets that they had just bought. There's a horrible mixture of periods throughout this film. You look, some of the rebels are firing, you know, World War II German Schmeisers. you get what you pay for to a certain extent. So I think it was more important they be firing, you know, that everybody had guns rather than everybody had maybe authentic guns. But anyway, so I found this footage and was able to, without harming the quality, bump it up to the CinemaScope format and cut it in. And, you know, it works quite well, and it's also was quite effective in the trailer in making the film look bigger than it really was. So that was 28 10-hour days.
Nice. Oh, man.
Awesome.
Well, like I said, Brian, thank you so much for chatting with us. There's so much more we could talk about. We should have to have you on again. I think was that Kung Fu?
Man from Hong Kong.
Man from Hong Kong.
You can pre-order, incidentally, mm-hmm. but it goes on official release on October the 25th. Okay.
Well, we'll have to grab that, and we'd love to talk to you about that film. I mean, I have all these other movies that I want to chat with you about, but we'll cut it for now. We'll save, give everyone a little, they'll have to wait for another time.
there are 8 million stories. This has been one of them.
Yes. Dead End Drive-In is out on Arrow Video right now. And, so you guys can grab that from them right now. It's this is a dual release, right, Brad?
No, this is just Blu-ray, right?
This is just a US release, right?
No, it's a UK.
No! I thought you meant Blu-ray DVD.
No, Blu-ray. Yeah. No, just a Blu-ray release. But was it a dual? Was it UK?
Yeah, it was US and UK.
Okay,
yeah.
Fantastic. So
yeah, Arrow are a UK based company.
Yeah,
I really applaud them. They went to a great deal of trouble. they put a lot into cleaning up the original interpositive.
Mm. It looks great.
So. It does look exactly the way I wanted it to look. The colors pop. Nice. I like popping colors, you know.
Me too. Yeah, the neon signs when you see the drive-in sign and everything, it just looks fantastic.
And reflected in the wet down.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we strategically placed that puddle so that the star neon would be reflected in that puddle before the car goes past.
Nice.
See, water doesn't cost you anything.
No.
The neon's paid for. The car's paid for. Where do you frame the shot? There you go.
Yep. All right. You guys can grab that Blu-ray right now. And
Headsman's Daughter.
Headsman's Daughter, yes. I have the links in the show notes to the book. Check it out, the digital or the hardcover, or not hardcover, but a hard copy, the soft cover. And Turkish Shoot is also out on Blu-ray as well. Let's see.
Lots of extras on that one too.
Yeah, that's a great disc.
Yeah, Severin put that out.
Yeah, and Drive Hard.
That was in my top 10 Blu-ray releases last year, I think.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Yes. So, yeah, I've been a long time fan. So,
and also check out Drive Hard, Brian's newest film.
Yeah, it's a quirky comedy.
I think RLJ put that out. I think.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, they did.
John Cusack.
Yeah, if you like John Cusack and Thomas,
it's funny. I think I reviewed it on the show before.
You did.
But it's funny. I like it.
Worth checking out. All right, Brian, thanks again. I look forward to talking to you again for sure.
Well, as you know, I hate a chat. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
All right, man. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. We got some bullshit to plug, though.
Oh, God. Yes, please.
We got these enamel pins that we've created, and the pre-order is...
Omar has created.
Omar's created, and we're
don't take all the credit.
I haven't done shit. I put these up on the website. But we got two of them. We got Bloody Ballet, which is of course a riff on the Dario Argento film Suspiria, and we got Oily O'Bannon, which is a riff on Return of the Living Dead crossed with Garbage Pail Kids. So they're both available for $10 each. The pre-order is
shipped
is up.
$10 shipped.
These should be arriving soon and shipping. The Oily O'Bannon should be coming in very soon.
I should be getting it. Today is Monday, the 17th?
Yeah.
I should be getting them on Wednesday or today. So next 3 days.
Yeah. So by the time you hear this, hopefully we'll start shipping them out. You know, you never know these things. You know, they may not ship on the exact day that we've said, but we're going to be getting these out
we'll get there
very soon. And I'm totally excited to have these myself. But grab those. They're only $10 each. Of course, there's a little added charge if you're international, so outside the U.S.
But we will work it out with you because we're not going to take your – what, we're charging $8?
Yeah, I mean, we had to do an estimate. So
we'll definitely be fair. And, you know, we'll combine pins if you want more to try
As I said, if you're ordering and you want these both, make sure you order them both together because it'll charge you only $8 for shipping, and make sure you order them together. I think I put that up on the site. I should say that. So that's over there at thescreamcast.com. Of course, other ways you can help the show is to check out our sponsors, grindhousevideo.com, of course. I always check them first before I go anywhere else.
Cheaper than Amazon.
Yep. Most of the time. Yep. Yeah. Vinegar Syndrome, of course, check them out. And of course, there is Horror Pack and Coffee Shop of Horrors. You can get 10% off if you use the coupon code SCREAMCAST.
And GLP Pins, Get Lapel Pins, who is the makers of our pins.
Yes.
So.
Yep.
Also, buy from them. Music. Great customer service.
Yes.
Cheap prices and a friendly smile.
Artwork design by Kevin Spencer. Music for the podcast, the opening and closing by Wolfman of Mars. Music that you've heard between the segments is from a band called Switchblade Saturdays.
Oh my God, are you playing music again?
Make sure you check them out.
All listeners are gone.
A good friend of mine, Zari, way back in the day, this is band. They have an EP out right now. It's pretty damn good. So check them out. SwitchbladeSaturdays.com. I'll put the link in the show notes. That is going to do it for this week's show.
How about Coffee Shop of Horrors?
I did it already.
Oh, okay.
You weren't paying attention.
Sometimes I drift in. Sometimes I drift in and out. Sorry.
Of course, follow us on social media. The links are over at thescreamcast.com, our Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, all that shit. We'll talk to all you guys next week. Thank you for listening.
I had a really good time.
Oh, by the way, no show next week. I'm on vacation. So we'll be picking up after that when I get back.
When do you go on vacation?
Next week.
Like next week?
Like when this show is posted, I will be heading to Northern California.
We're going to record one in the meantime. Watch this.
All right. Thank you guys for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Oh, don't tell me you're leaving. The party's just begun.